Chapter 5 Western Hemisphere Indians. The American continents existed geologically, much as we now know them, before the first human crossed over from the Eurasian mainland. If the Americas only became an environment with that migration, they also became a very different environment with the arrival of Columbus and the Spaniards. But if the New World was a different environment for the Europeans than it had been for the Indians, it was also a different environment for the European invaders than their homelands of Spain or England. Edward Whiting Fox. The various indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere have been no more alike in their economic, cultural, military, or other achievements than the various peoples of Europe, Asia, or Africa have been. Some Indians bartered, but others used money, kept accounts, and had sophisticated trading networks. Although some Indian tribes lived in tents, much like the nomads of the Middle East or Central Asia, others created buildings, monuments, and cities. When the Spanish conquistadores entered the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan in 1519, they found a city larger than Seville, from which many of the Spaniards had come. There were multi-storied dwellings built by some of the Indians in the American Southwest, centuries before the Europeans arrived. One four-tiered complex covered such a large area that it remained the largest apartment complex in North America until the 19th century. Stone masonry was also highly developed by the Maya, the Incas, and the Aztecs, among many other skills, both urban and agricultural. The maize that existed in the Western Hemisphere when the Europeans arrived was already a highly domesticated variety, so much so that it could no longer propagate itself in the wild, but had to be planted and tended by human beings. Since the Western Hemisphere includes two continents, each larger than Europe, it could hardly be expected that its peoples would be any less heterogeneous than the peoples of other regions of the world. Thus, while some of the indigenous peoples of the hemisphere, the Maya, Aztecs, and Incas, for example, had developed a complex urban civilization before the Europeans arrived, others in the Amazon jungle continued to live a primitive existence even in the late 20th century. Systems of government also varied enormously among the indigenous peoples of the hemisphere. At one extreme was the vast Incan Empire, ruled by an hereditary nobility, from whom a supreme ruler was chosen and endowed with godlike attributes, so much so that merely looking him in the eye was a crime punishable by death. At the other end of the spectrum were many of the Indian tribes of North America, in which chiefs were chosen ad hoc for particular purposes and wielded only such influence as other members of the tribe chose to accord them. In between were the governing systems of the Maya, in which rulers had great powers, but each over only limited geographical areas. While there were many impressive technological and intellectual achievements in the Western Hemisphere before the Europeans arrived, there were also things lacking in this hemisphere that were common elsewhere. Iron and steel were not produced by the Western Hemisphere Indians, even though it had been produced in Europe, Asia, and Africa for centuries before Columbus landed in the Americas. Indeed, iron and steel were important factors in the success of the European incursion, playing a major role in the weapons and armor which facilitated the Spaniards' conquests in Central and South America, and which, in North America, created on the Indians' part an eagerness to trade with the initially small and vulnerable European settlements on the coastal fringes of colonial America, because these settlements supplied iron and steel products that rapidly replaced existing kitchen utensils, knives, and other products made of various other materials among the Indians. The most striking lack in the Western Hemisphere before the arrival of Europeans was the wheel, often considered one of the landmarks on the road to the development of civilization. However, this lack was not simply an intellectual lack, for the Maya had wheels on the toys they made for their children, though not in practical adult uses. What was lacking was not the concept, but the complementary factor that made the wheel so important in Europe and Asia, namely, animals capable of pulling wheeled vehicles. There were no horses, oxen, or other animals capable of pulling or carrying heavy loads in either North or South America before the Europeans arrived. The other major factor lacking in most Western Hemisphere societies in pre-Columbian times was writing. Only the Maya in Central America had a fully developed system of writing, and most of the Indians of North America had not even rudimentary written versions of their languages. Thus, while the knowledge of the Europeans was more readily cumulative over time and more readily disseminated as of a given time, most of the indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere had to depend upon substitute methods of preserving and disseminating what they knew, such as personal memory and group traditions and songs, substitutes largely reduced to subordinate roles in other parts of the world after writing became available, and after such related systems of knowledge preservation as maps and numbering systems became available. The geographical setting. While in narrowly physical terms, the lands and waters of the Western Hemisphere were the same for the indigenous peoples as they would later be for the transplanted populations from Europe, the complete absence of horses, oxen, cattle, and sheep in the Western Hemisphere before the arrival of the Europeans was momentous in its implications for food supply in general, agriculture in particular, and above all for the size of the cultural universe available to any given Indian tribe, nation, or civilization. Horses and camels made the Silk Road a highway stretching thousands of miles across the Eurasian landmass to connect China with Europe, but nothing comparable was possible in the Western Hemisphere to connect the Iroquois on the Atlantic seaboard of North America with the Aztecs of Central America. Italians could acquire spaghetti from China, but the Iroquois could acquire nothing from the Aztecs, or even be aware of their existence. Agriculture in the Western Hemisphere was inherently limited to what could be accomplished without animal muscle power to carry or to pull loads or to plow the land, as well as to supply manure to maintain the fertility of farms. Land transport in general was obviously severely limited in the loads and the distances that were possible without animals. Even the navigable waterways were limited in their capacities to move cargo by the absence of pack animals and draft animals to transport these cargoes when they reached land. Indian canoes plied the inland and coastal waterways of the hemisphere long before the white man arrived, but larger vessels with greater cargo capacity would have exceeded the severe physical and economic limits of a land without the kinds of animals needed to make larger cargoes economically viable. Llamas were available as pack animals in limited regions of South America, and dogs were used by Eskimos and by some North American Plains Indians to pull loads, but these animals did not compare with horses or oxen in what they could transport. As in much of sub-Saharan Africa, not only were loads and distances limited physically in the Western Hemisphere by an absence of the needed animals, the particular kinds of things that would be economically feasible to trade at considerable distances were even more limited economically to those things whose concentrated value could repay high transport costs, often involving human porters. Tons of grain, for example, could be shipped for hundreds of miles in Europe, but not in the Western Hemisphere before the Europeans arrived and brought pack animals and draft animals. Even in those regions of the Western Hemisphere that had networks of waterways comparable to those in Western Europe, limitations on land transport limited cargoes transported by water. Moreover, limitations on the scope and range of trade were also limitations on the scope and range of cultural interchanges. Specific geographic barriers, the Amazon jungle, the Rocky Mountains, or the vast desert in what is today the southwestern United States, were of course major barriers to large-scale cultural interaction in pre-Columbian times, but the absence of animals for transport was a more general barrier to long-range cultural interactions throughout the Americas. While these barriers were not as severe as the geographic barriers in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, they were more formidable than those in much of Europe and Asia. The absence of herd animals, like sheep and cattle, as well as the absence of load-bearing or load-pulling animals, like horses and oxen, had another consequence. An absence of the many diseases carried by such animals, and often acquired by human beings living in close proximity with these animals. While, in one sense, the absence of such diseases was of course a benefit, their absence also meant an absence of biological resistance to many potentially devastating diseases, such as smallpox. So long as such diseases did not exist in the Western Hemisphere, the Indians' lack of biological resistance to them was of no consequence. But, once people from Europe began arriving with these diseases, the consequences were momentous, not only for those indigenous populations stricken and devastated by these diseases at the time, but also for the historic transfer of North and South America from the indigenous peoples to the European invaders. The most invincible of these invaders proved to be not the Europeans themselves, but the invisible carriers of their diseases, whose existence neither they nor the Indians suspected. The fact that the Eurasian landmass stretches predominantly east and west, while the Western Hemisphere landmasses stretch predominantly north and south, means that advances in agriculture and animal husbandry could spread more readily over far more distances in the Old World than in the New. Plants and animals are more similar in the same latitudes, while more drastic climate changes accompany north-south movement. Thus, rice cultivation could spread across Asia to Europe and ultimately to North America, but bananas could not spread from Central America to Canada, nor could many of the animals adapted to the tropics survive in the colder climates to the north or south, so that knowledge of how to hunt or domesticate these animals was similarly restricted in how far it would be applicable, even if such knowledge could be transmitted over long distances. Moreover, the northern temperate zone and the southern temperate zone of the Western Hemisphere were too far apart to make any sharing of knowledge between them feasible in pre-Columbian times. In short, climate, like other aspects of geography, limited the size of the cultural universes of the indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere. The geographical environment of the Western Hemisphere itself changed with the European conquest. Vast herds of new animals were transplanted from Europe, along with the invisible transplanting of a whole new disease environment and a whole new technology from Europe. These transplantations changed the lives of the indigenous peoples, as well as allowing the European settlers to bring much of their cultural world to the Americas. Mounted Indian warriors with herds of cattle became a traditional way of life on the western plains of the United States, for example, while the gauchos who herded cattle for Spanish landowners on the Argentina Pampas were often part or full-blooded Indians as well. Such physical features of the Western Hemisphere as natural harbors and rivers reaching deep inland from the sea now became far more important economically after the arrival of white invaders and settlers in ships developed in Europe, but better adapted to exploit New World conditions than were the canoes of the Indians. Those parts of the Western Hemisphere most highly developed by the Europeans were not the same as those that had been most highly developed by the indigenous peoples. Whereas the most advanced Indian civilizations developed in Central America and in the Andes Mountains, the most advanced regions developed by Europeans were those regions whose geography was most like that of Western Europe, places with natural harbors and broad coastal plains, crisscrossed by rivers deep enough to carry large ships, and eventually, places with the mineral deposits needed to build an industrial society. Only in the narrowest physical sense was the geographic setting of the Western Hemisphere the same for the indigenous peoples and for the Europeans. The flora, the fauna, and the disease environments were changed radically, and the natural features of the land and the waters acquired a much wider range of possibilities as a result of this, as well as because of the new technology brought from Europe. Moreover, the technology that the Europeans brought to the Western Hemisphere was not simply the technology of Europe. Because of the geography of the Eurasian landmass, Europeans were able to bring to bear in the Western Hemisphere the cultural features of lands extending far beyond Europe, but incorporated into their civilization. Europeans were able to cross the Atlantic Ocean in the first place because they could steer with rudders invented in China, calculate their position on the open sea through trigonometry invented in Egypt, using numbers created in India. The knowledge they had accumulated from around the world was preserved in letters invented by the Romans and written on paper invented in China. The military power they brought with them increasingly depended on weapons using gunpowder, also invented in Asia. The cultural confrontation in the Western Hemisphere was, in effect, a one-sided struggle between cultures acquired from vast regions of the Earth against cultures from more narrowly circumscribed regions of the New World. Never have the advantages of a wider cultural universe been more dramatically or more devastatingly demonstrated than in the conquests that followed. Conquests and cultures. When the Europeans arrived in the Western Hemisphere, these invaders behaved, by and large, as conquerors have behaved all over the world for thousands of years, which is to say, brutally, greedily, and with arrogance toward the conquered peoples. Indeed, that is very much the way that Indian conquerors behaved toward other Indians, long before Columbus's ships first appeared on the horizon. However, Europeans' discovery of the Western Hemisphere was not only a watershed in the history of the indigenous peoples of the New World, it was one of the most momentous events in the history of the human race. For this discovery meant that each half of the planet now became aware of the other half's existence and began a massive interchange of material things and cultures, as well as a massive movement of people across the Atlantic. Nothing would ever be the same again in either half of the world. Foods never seen before would become crucial to the diets of people thousands of miles away, the potato in Ireland, for example, and commercial crops never grown before, such as rubber in Malaya and cocoa in Nigeria, would become mainstays of national economies. Sweet potatoes would become a defense against famine in China, which ended up producing more of this Western Hemisphere vegetable than the rest of the world put together. Transfers in the other direction were also of major and transforming importance. In a hemisphere that had never seen horses before, many Indians on the American plains would become skilled horsemen, hunting and fighting mounted and using firearms. For the first time in history, millions of people would migrate across an ocean, by choice from Europe and by force from Africa, and whole new disease environments would intermingle, with devastating impact on the native peoples of North and South America. The introduction of liquor was likewise devastating and even longer lasting in its effects than the new diseases, to which the surviving remnants of the original Indian population eventually acquired biological resistance. While the disease transfer was not all one way, an epidemic of syphilis broke out in Europe after the return of Columbus's ships from the Western Hemisphere. Still, the Europeans were not nearly as affected by the diseases of the Indians as the latter were by the diseases from Europe. In the tropical regions of the New World, however, both the Europeans and the Indians proved to be vulnerable to yellow fever from Africa. In one way or another, and to varying degrees from place to place, American Indians would be incorporated over the centuries into a very different set of cultures from Europe. Both the natural and the man-made catastrophes they suffered undermined faith in their existing traditions and leaders, who were largely unable to ward off these new catastrophes. After a smallpox epidemic in the early 18th century killed nearly half the Cherokees, medicine men were repudiated, and the Cherokees began to regard European doctors as more knowledgeable. Earlier Indian survivors of a devastating epidemic in the vicinity of the European settlement at Roanoke interpreted their plight religiously as evidence that the god of the Europeans was more powerful than the Indian gods. In short, the indigenous population of the hemisphere was deprived not only of land and freedom, they were, to varying degrees, deprived also of the underlying foundation of cultural traditions on which any society is based. In parts of the Western Hemisphere, they would be largely absorbed biologically as well. In the United States, very few American Indians were of unmixed ancestry by the late 20th century, and in much of Hispanic America, mestizos generally outnumbered pure-blooded Indians, and in some places, outnumbered people of pure-blooded European ancestry as well. Since most of the peoples of the Western Hemisphere lacked any system of writing before the Europeans came, their pre-Columbian history, like the history of early Anglo-Saxon England and the early history of the Slavs, sub-Saharan Africans, and other non-literate peoples around the world, can only be sketchily pieced together from archaeological and other clues. The very population of the hemisphere before the first white men arrived remains a matter of conjecture and controversy. One scholar estimated the pre-Columbian population of the hemisphere as low as 8.4 million, while another estimate put it at from 90 million to 112 million. What is clearer is that the population density varied, being greater in South America than in North America, greater along the coasts than in the interior, and greater on the Pacific coast than on the Atlantic coast. As in other parts of the world, population densities tended to be greatest where there was more highly developed agriculture, as in the Aztec and Inca empires, and sparsest where hunting and gathering societies predominated. Hunter-gatherers in what is today Mexico were looked down upon as barbarians by the more sophisticated Indian civilizations of the region, as more advanced societies have disdained, conquered, enslaved, or exterminated hunter-gatherers in other parts of the world. The indigenous population of the Western Hemisphere declined catastrophically after the diseases of Europe struck peoples with little or no biological resistance to these diseases. By the end of the 19th century, the Indian population of the United States was between a third and a fourth of what it is estimated to have been when the first white men arrived. The devastation was even worse in other parts of the Western Hemisphere. Despite differing estimates today of the absolute size of the population of Mexico when the Spaniards arrived in the 16th century, there is broad agreement on the drastic shrinkage of that population in the century after 1520, a decline from 22 million Indians to just 2 million. The indigenous population of Peru likewise declined by approximately 90% after the Spanish conquest there. The 20th century American Indian population of Brazil was less than 5% of its estimated level when Europeans arrived. In the Caribbean, the indigenous population was virtually annihilated. The horrendous impact of new diseases may have had at least as much to do with the Indians losing control of the hemisphere to Europeans as the military encounters between the two, in which the technological advantage generally lay with the invaders. While it has not been uncommon in history for a smaller military force from a more developed society to prevail over a numerically superior force from a society less technologically or organizationally advanced, the Roman invaders of Britain or the European invaders of Africa, for example, nevertheless, the numerical disparity in the Western Hemisphere was extreme. Whether the lowest or the highest estimate of the population of the Western Hemisphere in pre-Columbian times is closer to the facts, there were still millions of Indians, and probably tens of millions. Yet, the entire European population of the Western Hemisphere had not yet reached 1 million as late as the middle of the 17th century, more than 150 years after Columbus arrived. By that time, the Spaniards alone had established an empire that stretched from San Francisco Bay to the River Plate in Argentina. Comparisons of the size of the Indian and European populations as of the early generations after Columbus can be misleading, however, insofar as such comparisons suggest that there was a simple race war for possession of the hemisphere. Neither the Indians nor the whites were united, so that both alliances and battles took place across racial lines. Many Indians allied themselves with the newcomers in warfare against other Indians, for revenge against erstwhile Indian conquerors and oppressors, or to share in the spoils of war, or to gain other advantages. Similarly, the Europeans fought among themselves for a variety of reasons and had Indian allies against fellow Europeans. The British and French, for example, clashed repeatedly in battle in North America, as they did around the world, and both had Indian allies in these battles. In addition, there were simple European versus European battles, as there were Indian versus Indian battles. The Dutch sent a naval squadron to attack the British settlement in Virginia, and the British government under Cromwell sent expeditionary forces to colonial America to force the surrender of royalist governments in various British colonies on the North American continent and in the Caribbean. In South America, rival contingents of Spaniards fought among themselves over the spoils of the Incan Empire. And, when much of this treasure was shipped off to Spain, British privateers waited on the high seas to intercept it. In short, colonial-era rivalries and alliances were not based on race, but on expediency. In 1701, a letter written by a British colonial official spoke of the Iroquois Indians to the west as the only barrier against the French forces, including the Indian allies of the French. As late as the first few decades of the newly created United States, major military battles between whites and Indians remained rare in this part of the hemisphere. Certainly as compared to the hundreds of battles per decade that would later occur in the United States after the middle of the 19th century, when a now vastly larger white population sought far more land and had both the numbers and the military equipment to take it. Even during this later era, however, much of the land transfer from Indians to whites in the United States was through what might be called semi-conquest, as the American government paid millions of dollars to Indians for their land, but only about half of what that land would bring in the market. Many of the conquests of the Western Hemisphere were not like the conquests of modern Europe, where one organized state attacks another militarily and, after defeating it on the battlefield, takes over its territory and its sovereignty over the people living there. Many of the early European conquests in the Western Hemisphere were a series of uncoordinated campaigns by fighting units operating under the general auspices of the governments of Spain or Portugal, but by no means always under the effective direction or control of rulers or officials on the other side of the Atlantic. Given the slowness of communications in the era of wind-driven ships, news of what was being done in the name of Spain or Portugal often reached the Iberian Peninsula long after it was a fait accompli. Even Spanish viceroys in the Western Hemisphere could lose control of the situation some distance away, as both Cortes in Mexico and Pizarro in Peru ignored the orders of their Spanish superiors in the New World. The British colonies in North America were likewise settled and expanded in piecemeal and often uncoordinated ways, typically by land purchase rather than military conquest in early colonial times. However, even in a given colony, such as Pennsylvania, the treaties made with the Indians by the Quaker leadership in Philadelphia were often ignored by the Scotch-Irish settlers on the western frontiers, who tended to settle on whatever land they found desirable, without worrying about whether it was inside or outside some line drawn on a map in Philadelphia. Given the Scotch-Irish tradition of occupying land they had not bought, whether in Britain, America, or Australia, this could hardly be surprising. Long after a growing population and an improving weapons technology put the Europeans clearly in the ascendancy throughout the hemisphere, there were still large frontier regions where Indians maintained their independence and their ability to fight. In 18th century Argentina, for example, Spanish frontier settlements were often subjected to Indian raids, during which captives would be taken away by the Indians, often to be either ransomed later or to be retained as slaves, including concubines, for the Indians preferred capturing women and killing men, while children would be raised as members of the tribe. It was very common for Indian tribes to have Spanish captives, nor were the numbers involved negligible. During a long Spanish military campaign against the Indians in Argentina, more than 600 captives were freed. Their average period of captivity was nearly 9 years. Much more common was the practice of paying ransom to get back individual Spaniards who had been carried off. Some Spanish men also escaped, but women were less likely to do so, and in fact, some women who were ransomed later returned to the Indian communities voluntarily, for their status in Spanish society was now degraded, since they were considered to have been dishonored by being concubines of Indians. The capture of whites and their retention among the Indians was not a phenomenon limited to Argentina by any means. A mid-18th century report on the aftermath of Indian raids on European frontier settlements in western Pennsylvania stated, "The Indian villages are full of prisoners of every age and sex. White women captured by the Iroquois likewise often chose to remain with them, because the white settler society from which they came also considered them ruined." The importance of the discovery of the Western Hemisphere by Europeans continued to be enormous, long after the Age of Discovery itself. In addition to the new foods, medicinal herbs, and tobacco received from the Americas, Europe developed a massive trade with the colonies, and later independent nations, of the New World. Centuries-old patterns of trade in Europe were disrupted, and in some cases destroyed, by a shift in the directions of commerce. The relative importance of the Levant as a supply center for international trade from the Middle East and the Far East declined as the Americas replaced both international and internal European supply sources for a variety of products. Eventually, massive shipments of wheat from Argentina and the United States provided the daily bread of increasing numbers of Europeans and deprived many European wheat-growing peasants of their livelihoods. Sugar went from being a luxury of a few in Europe to being an item of mass consumption, supplied by the plantations of the Western Hemisphere. Cotton from the New World likewise reached the masses in Europe, making clothing more affordable than woolen garments had been. Nor was this a small contribution. In pre-industrial Europe, where ordinary people spent more than half their income for food, clothing was something purchased only a few times in a lifetime. Markets in second-hand clothing flourished, and hospitals had to guard against having clothes stolen from corpses by people desperate for something to wear. In these circumstances, cotton from the New World was a major contribution to the European standard of living. Gold and silver from the Western Hemisphere arrived in Europe in amounts vast enough to raise price levels across the continent, and to enable Europe to finance its chronic trade deficits with Asia, which at that time had little or no demand for European products, while Europeans imported silk, tea, and other Asian goods. In a period of about a century and a half, beginning in the early 16th century, 185,000 kilograms of gold were shipped to Spain from the Western Hemisphere, increasing the total amount of gold in Europe by about one-fifth. Even more vast amounts of silver flowed to Spain, more than 7 million pounds during the same period, tripling the supply of silver in Europe. The Golden Age of Spain in the 16th century owed much to the gold and silver that poured in from Spanish colonies in the Western Hemisphere. Spain's decline in the next century, as the supplies of these precious metals declined, revealed its own lack of internal economic development. Its lack of skilled labor and its cultural disdain for either labor or commerce, both historically supplied largely by Jews and by Moorish Christians before both were expelled in the late 15th and early 16th century, left Spain without the human capital to make its financial capital from the New World anything more than an historically transient source of spending by individuals and government. By the mid-17th century, with imports vastly exceeding exports, silver could become scarce in Spain in a matter of weeks after the arrival of ships laden with silver from its American colonies. Among the Spaniards themselves, gold was said to pour down on Spain like rain on a roof, flowing on away immediately. More than a material impact was made by the New World on the old. A mental revolution was set in motion as well. After centuries of looking back with reverence to the superior achievements of the Roman Empire, and to both the secular and religious authorities of ancient times, Europeans began to comment widely on the fact that these ancients never knew of the existence of half the world, and so could not be such infallible guides. This undermining of ancient authority was one of the Western Hemisphere's inadvertent contributions to the changing of the mental universe of Europeans, a change also brought on by the rise of science and of scientific discoveries as dramatic as geographic discoveries. Europeans now began to look forward rather than backward, and progress became a major theme of European thought and action, for better or worse. Yet, despite the great long-run contribution of the Western Hemisphere to both the material and the immaterial development of Europe, which now seems so clear in retrospect, this does not necessarily mean that the New World immediately preoccupied Europeans proportionately at the time of its discovery and colonization. In France, for example, more than twice as many books printed between 1480 and 1700 dealt with the Ottoman Empire as dealt with the Western Hemisphere. For the Indians of North and South America, the cultural impact of the Europeans was also enormous, in at least two very different ways. In addition to what was learned directly from the Europeans, the Indians were forced to adapt to conquests which deprived them of the land and resources necessary for their previous ways of life, which could not always be resumed in the new environments to which they retreated, even when they were able to retain their own social traditions and governing practices. Moreover, just as the discovery of a vast and unsuspected hemisphere undermined Europeans' faith in their ancient forebears and their traditions, so the stunning series of military setbacks suffered by the Indians in that hemisphere undermined confidence in their leaders, traditions, and cultures. One consequence was a receptivity of many Indians to Christian missionaries, who brought with them the secular as well as the religious offerings of European culture. Thus, by the end of the 17th century, little more than isolated pockets of purely indigenous religions survived in the vast domains of the Spanish Empire in the Americas. However, some or much of the traditional content of these religions might survive under the outward forms of Christianity, as other syncretistic religions emerged in other regions of the world where conquerors brought a different religion, such as in the Balkans under Ottoman rule or India under a series of invaders. Ironically, the enslavement of the indigenous Indians by the invading peoples was facilitated where there was a sufficiently advanced Indian culture to support large concentrations of people in a relatively compact region, such as in areas once ruled by the Aztecs or the Incas. Enslaving less advanced tribes of hunters and gatherers, spread thinly over the vast areas required for their subsistence, was much less feasible, either militarily or economically. Other organized Indian nations, with many warriors, were also not likely candidates for enslavement. To some extent, there was a selling of Indian captives by other Indians in North America. However, by and large, the Europeans found it expedient to take land from the Indians and to get the labor to work that land either from Europe or from Africa. No one knows when the Indians themselves first came to the Western Hemisphere, but archaeological evidence suggests that they did not originate in the Americas. Unlike other parts of the world, North and South America contain no skeletal remains of earlier forms of human beings or their ancestors, suggesting that people had already reached their present stage of physical development before the Indians settled in the hemisphere. Hundreds of different languages were spoken by the Indians, and, while these can be grouped into families of similar languages, they are not related to other languages in Europe, Africa, or Asia, except for Eskimo being spoken on both the Asian and the North American sides of the Bering Straits. It is here that the Indian peoples are thought to have entered the Western Hemisphere from Asia in prehistoric times. Europeans from the Iberian Peninsula were the earliest explorers, conquerors, and colonizers of the Western Hemisphere. A decade after Columbus's first landing in the Western Hemisphere in 1492, Brazil wood was being shipped to Portugal from the country that would later be named for that wood. That same year, 1502, a Spanish expedition of 30 ships with 2,500 men landed in Santo Domingo. In the early 16th century, Spanish explorers spread into Central and South America. From the Isthmus of Panama, Balboa first saw the ocean he named Pacific in 1513. 6 years later, Cortes began his conquest of Mexico, and in 1530, Pizarro launched his expedition from Panama southward to conquer the Incan Empire. The Dutch, then a major naval power and engaged in a long war with Spain, followed next, and then the English, a rising power at the time, but not yet at their zenith, followed in the wake of the Dutch. Meanwhile, the French set up island colonies in the Caribbean and settlements on the North American mainland, extending from what is today Canada on down through the vast reaches of the Mississippi Valley to New Orleans. This order in time and in power among the European imperial nations in the Western Hemisphere roughly reflected their worldwide positions. The Spaniards were the premier imperial nation, not only in power, but also in experience in projecting that power overseas and establishing dominion over less advanced overseas populations, having conquered the Canary Islands years before Columbus set sail. Britain was simply not in Spain's league as of the time the Western Hemisphere was discovered. Spain was consolidating its victories over the Aztecs and the Incas, while England was annexing Wales. In addition to their imperial possessions in the Americas and in Europe, the Spaniards were in the Philippines before the British were in India, Ceylon, Malaysia, or other Asian regions of what would later become the British Empire. Europe itself had only recently repelled the incursions of non-European powers, with Columbus's first voyage being launched the same year that the Spaniards' centuries-long struggle to reconquer their own land from the ruling Moors achieved final victory in Granada. Russians only ceased paying tribute to Mongol overlords during the same century, and the Ottoman Empire was still advancing up through the Balkans toward Central Europe. As imperialists, Western Europeans were unique only in being able to project their naval and military power across the oceans of the world. The Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire were great powers among their contemporaries, but primarily on land. While the gold and silver of the Spanish colonies poured into Europe, so in massive amounts did the animal hides and furs of North America from the British, French, and Dutch, who acquired them in trade with the Indians. The Portuguese established the sugar plantations in Brazil that would change the diets of Europe and change the history of the Western Hemisphere, as sugar plantations spread rapidly into the British, French, Spanish, and Dutch islands of the Caribbean, all using vast numbers of slaves from Africa. Before the middle of the 17th century, Dutch forces had seized Brazil from the Portuguese, as they had seized Portuguese possessions on the coast of Africa, and established Dutch colonies in North America, the most notable being New Amsterdam, later to be renamed New York, after the British seized it from the Dutch. The British were, however, latecomers compared to the Iberians. It was a century after Cortes conquered the Aztecs that the British founded a colony in Massachusetts in 1630. The French founded Quebec in 1608 and Montreal in 1642. Their trade and territorial expansions brought them into conflict with the British, particularly those based in New York, but also including the British in settlements up and down the eastern seaboard of what would later become the United States. Central and South America. Central America was the scene of the earliest civilizations of the Western Hemisphere, notably that of the Olmecs, and what has been called the New World's most brilliant civilization, that of the Maya. The largest empire, however, was in South America, that of the Incas. By and large, all these civilizations were more advanced than those of the Indians of North America, and far more advanced than those found in the Caribbean, although more primitive tribes also existed in the jungles of South America. What was particularly remarkable about the civilizations of Central America was that they are among the few examples of such advanced societies developing in tropical rainforests. The Incan civilization also developed within tropical latitudes, but at largely higher altitudes, so that it did not have to contend with tropical climate and tropical diseases. The Maya. The ancient Maya civilization was one of the great civilizations of the Western Hemisphere, and the only one with a fully developed written language. It also had a well-developed numbering system, arguably better than the contemporary Roman numerals in use in Europe, a calendar, elaborate artwork, knowledge of astronomy, and urban developments with massive buildings and monuments. One labyrinthine Mayan palace, for example, was roughly 300 feet long and 240 feet wide. Although the Maya, like other indigenous peoples of the hemisphere, had no metal tools, they had a volcanic glass called obsidian, which was used for cutting, as were stone tools. What is considered the classical period of Mayan civilization extended from the middle of the 3rd century AD to the beginning of the 10th century. In other words, it had its rise and fall before the first European arrived on the scene. Yet the Maya culture was not completely obliterated, even by the Spanish conquest of the 16th century, and there were still 6 million Maya in the late 20th century, one of whom won a Nobel Prize. The site of Mayan civilization was the Yucatan Peninsula and the adjoining mainland. Here the soil, the waterways, and the climate varied considerably, ranging from deserts to rainforests, from tropical lowlands to cool volcanic highlands, and from seashores to deep interior hinterlands. Rainfall ranges from less than 40 inches annually in much of the northern Yucatan Peninsula to more than 100 inches annually in some of the southern highlands. The northern portion of the peninsula has been characterized as virtually a solid limestone rock covered with soil that tends to be thin physically in some places and not very fertile, even where it is deeper. Because water drains so readily through the limestone, rivers are rare in this region and irrigation impractical. Therefore, in northern and central Yucatan, water for farming comes almost entirely from rain. To the south, where there is thicker soil, there are rivers and lakes. Altitude also increases toward the south, at a rate of about 20 centimeters, 8 inches per kilometer. Early Mayan agriculture developed within these geographical and climatic limits by allowing land to lie fallow for a number of years in between plantings. To the south, the land lay fallow from 4 to 7 years, and in the north, from 8 to 20 years. Before replanting, the land was burned, so that nutrients from the burned vegetation would fertilize the soil. As in the rest of the Western Hemisphere, there were no draft animals to provide manure for fertilization. Under these circumstances, vastly more land was required to support a given population than the land actually under cultivation at any given time. The highly varied flora and fauna in the various regions of Mayan civilization and the varying climatic and geographical conditions provided the basis for trade in the differing products of the respective regions, with accompanying cultural interactions over wide areas. The earliest Mayan urban communities of the classical era arose in locations commanding the lowland trade routes. Even after this era had passed, more than 60% of the Maya population lived along the major trade routes, making their living from a combination of agriculture, fishing, salt gathering, and commerce. So developed was trade that coastal communities did not have to be able to feed themselves from the agriculture in their immediate vicinity, but obtained food, textiles, and other products from the interior hinterlands. Like other great civilizations, that of the Maya borrowed heavily from those who went before and from contemporaries, Its language contained loan words from other languages, and its calendar apparently came from the older Olmec civilization, while aspects of the culture of the later Toltec civilization eventually amalgamated with the culture of the Maya. With all its intellectual and material accomplishments, Mayan civilization could hardly be considered humanitarian. One of its central priorities was war, and one of its chief priorities in war was the capture, torture, and slaughter of enemy soldiers and leaders. As a scholar specializing in the history of the Maya put it, "The highest goal of these lineage-proud dynasts was to capture the ruler of a rival city-state in battle, to torture and humiliate him, sometimes for years, and then to subject him to decapitation following a ball game which the prisoner was always destined to lose." While atrocities have occurred around the world, this was a society in which such behavior was not simply accepted, but systematized and celebrated. Mayan art and writing featured scenes of captured enemies cut open while alive, or being tortured and pleading with their captors, their leaders being debased by Mayan leaders, and Mayan warriors wearing coats decorated with the shrunken heads of their victims. Human sacrifice was a feature of Mayan culture, as it was among the Aztecs and Incas. Those sacrificed included not only captured enemies, but also adults and children killed to be buried with Mayan leaders, presumably to provide someone to look after their needs in the next world. Nor were enemy victims simply incidental casualties of war. Some military actions were undertaken precisely in order to obtain captives to kill in celebration of the accession of a new ruler. The extent of the Mayan culture was at no time the same as the extent of any Mayan political entity. There were always numerous rulers over different regions where Mayan culture prevailed. Among the various regions, some were paramount at one period and others at other periods. One region which long remained dominant during the classical Mayan era was that centered on the urban community of Tikal. Although Mayan civilization had buildings, monuments, and other characteristics of urban settings, these communities did not reach the size and density of later Aztec or Incan cities, or the size and density of leading cities in contemporary Europe, at least in their urban cores. However, including the surrounding area, an estimated 92,000 people lived in and around Tikal. Some other Mayan urban centers also had populations in the tens of thousands. Highland communities were smaller and less important, both politically and economically, than those in the lowlands that were the heart and origin of Mayan civilization. Somewhere around the 9th century, for reasons that remain unclear and the subject of controversy among archaeologists, Mayan civilization began to decline. Throughout the southern lowlands, building and carving activities declined substantially, along with the decline in ceramics and other manufactured products. Hundreds of sites were abandoned. Populations in the great urban centers of the Mayan lowlands declined, and some communities were abandoned. Judging by the depictions of rulers in Mayan art, this era of decline saw also the decline of the godlike individual ruler, who now shared power with a ruling elite. Although leading lowland communities declined or disappeared during this era, there was an offsetting rise in population and prosperity in the Yucatan Peninsula. By the time the Spaniards arrived on the scene, centuries later, the great centers of Mayan civilization were already ruins, some overgrown by jungle, though much of the intangible culture still survived. However, long before the Spanish invasion, indigenous invaders brought a new infusion of peoples and cultures to the Mayan regions. The earliest known contact between the Maya and the Spaniards occurred in 1511, when several survivors of a Spanish shipwreck were captured by the Maya, became human sacrifices, and their bodies were eaten at a feast. Other survivors of the same shipwreck were deemed too thin for a feast and were kept for a later holiday that was approaching, by which time they might be fattened up. In the meantime, they escaped. 6 years later, a contingent of Spanish warriors from Cuba, searching for people to enslave on the Central American mainland, encountered the Maya, with whom they fought a battle in which the Spaniards suffered heavy losses, including numerous wounds to their leader, who died after his return to Cuba. 2 years later, the Spaniards returned with 4 ships and 200 men for vengeance. Again, the Maya attacked, killing 1 and wounding 50, including the leader of the second expedition, who returned to Cuba in frustration. The next expedition into Mayan territory, in 1519, was more formidable and was commanded by Hernan Cortes, conqueror of the people known as the Mexica and future conqueror of the Aztecs. He led an armada of 11 ships with 500 men. The Spaniards came ashore, destroyed idols in the local temples, and erected a cross in one of them. In the course of their expedition through the Mayan region, Cortes was given a young orphaned girl named Marina, who spoke two of the languages of the region and who became his translator as well as his concubine, facilitating his making of alliances with various indigenous peoples who seized opportunities to attack and plunder their traditional enemies. Thus, Cortes eventually came to command an army vastly larger than the Spanish contingent with which he landed. After Cortes conquered the Aztec capital in 1521, he dispatched one of his officers on an expedition into Mayan territory. Spanish priest Bartolomé de las Casas described these conquests. He advanced, killing, ravaging, burning, robbing, and destroying all the country where he came. The atrocities being reported by de las Casas were not, however, matters of glorification, as such things were among the Maya, but part of his years-long moral indictments of the Spanish treatment of the peoples of the Western Hemisphere. Eventually, his reports and the reports of other Spanish priests raised sufficient concern in Spain to lead to admonitions, reforms, and occasionally punishments of the guilty in Spanish America, though these were seldom sufficient to prevent continuing brutalities and oppressions. Although the Spanish conquistadores inflicted crushing defeats and spread mass terror among Mayan communities in the 1520s, this did not bring the entire Mayan region under their control, for there was no single government controlling all the Maya, and never had been. This meant, on the one hand, that united Mayan resistance to the Spaniards did not develop, but on the other hand, it also meant that no Spanish victory, no matter how decisive, would bring all the Maya under their control. It was very much like the medieval English conquests in Ireland, in that respect. In Central America, more than 20 years elapsed between the first brutal conquests of the Maya in 1523, described by de las Casas, and the Spaniards' final subjugation of the Yucatan Peninsula in 1546. Even so, another Mayan nation, the Itza, held out for more than another century and a half. The Spanish conquests in Yucatan subjected the Maya to economic exactions, religious impositions, and social subordination, a fate that befell other Indians elsewhere in the hemisphere. The Maya had to pay tribute to individual local Spanish overlords, much as under feudalism in Europe, and tithes to the Catholic Church, as well as being subjected to a certain amount of forced labor and forcible relocation to communities in which religious or secular leaders could more readily control them and attempt to convert them to the Christian religion and Hispanic culture. Millions were forcibly relocated in the years 1550 to 1563. In addition to various officially sanctioned means of exploiting the Maya, Spaniards in power on the scene were also able to enrich themselves and their families and friends by extra-legal oppressions and chicanery practiced against the Indians in violation of the rules of the Spanish state and the Catholic Church. Throughout New Spain, encompassing what is now Mexico and much of Central America, as well as the southwestern United States, Spanish conquerors established a variety of overlapping and often conflicting political and economic institutions. One of the most important of these was the encomienda, sometimes likened to a feudal fief, except that it was not a property held in perpetuity, but usually a trust granted by the Spanish authorities for a specified number of generations, sometimes just for one generation, supposedly as rewards to the conquering warriors, but often as rewards for being relatives and friends of Spanish colonial officials. As under feudalism, people as well as land were part of the encomienda, and their tribute in money, in kind, or in labor was what supported the ruling overlords individually as well as the colonial government in general. Many Indian communities changed hands, often more than once. Among the duties of the holder of an encomienda was converting the Indians to Christianity and limiting how much tribute could be collected from them or how they could be treated. The carrying out of these official policies varied, however, according to the individuals and the circumstances. Some Indians were in fact worked to death, and others were sold as slaves to islands in the Caribbean. Some of these violations were more or less open secrets, typically things which the Spanish crown was reluctant to attempt to suppress or punish, at least until much later, when its effective power was greater, or when some benefit would accrue to the Spanish government itself as a result of cracking down. The primary relief from the abuses of the conquerors came not from the government in Spain, but from escape to parts of the region not yet under effective Spanish control. This occurred on such a scale as to cause the Spaniards to launch sporadic military operations to recapture escapees by the thousands and return them to the particular jurisdictions and overlords from which they had escaped. There were also widespread Indian rebellions. One of the devastating impacts of European conquests among the Maya, as among other indigenous peoples throughout the Western Hemisphere, was a massive spread of new diseases, causing deaths on such a scale as to drastically reduce the total population and undermine military resistance by the Indians. The Yucatec Maya, for example, numbered perhaps as many as 800,000 people at the time of the Spanish conquest, but this number fell to about 233,000 by 1550 and to 163,000 by 1601. Afterwards, population size stabilized, and, before the middle of the 17th century, began an increase. It is not clear how much of the population decline represented the effects of disease alone, and how much migrations and escapes from Spanish rule. However, it is known that communities along the trade routes were especially hard hit by contagious diseases that spread as traders moved along such routes, leading to actual depopulations in some communities. In addition to the European diseases introduced by the Spaniards, tropical yellow fever from Africa was also spread as a result of the introduction of African slaves into the region. Yellow fever wreaked havoc among both the Spaniards and the Maya, and continued to be a problem in Yucatan on into the 20th century. Unlike the ancient Roman conquest of Britain or some of the European conquests in Africa, the Spanish conquest of the Maya did not bring major technological or organizational advances. While horses and mules were introduced, facilitating trade, that trade was carried on almost exclusively by the Maya. Mayan agriculture and Mayan weaving of cloth, two of the major economic activities of the region, remained much as they had been before the Spaniards came, and the Spaniards themselves seldom engaged in either of these activities. What changed most fundamentally was not the nature of economic activity, but the amount extracted from the producers and the elite to whom it was transferred. The old ruling Maya elite became a subordinate elite under the Spaniards, who now became the real power, gradually reducing the various classes among the indigenous population as a whole to the role of peasants, and their religion and culture to things openly disdained. As a result of continuing inflows of people from Spain and from Africa, and the biological amalgamations that produced mestizos and mulattoes, as well as the cultural Hispanicization of the Maya and other Indians, people of both Mayan ancestry and Mayan culture eventually became a minority in their own land. Biologically, however, Indians as a whole continued to be a majority of the population in most of Yucatan in the late 18th century. The Spaniards were about 8% of the total population, outnumbered by people of partial or full African ancestry, who were 12% of the population. These people of African ancestry tended to be part of the Hispanic culture. What the Spanish conquerors created in the regions where Mayan civilization had once prevailed was not a colony in the strict classical sense of a society consisting largely of transplanted members of the conquering race, as in British North America, nor was it either feudalism or capitalism. While the relationship between local Spanish overlords and the Indians subject to their command and demands was feudalistic in one sense, it never attempted to produce the self-sufficient domains which feudalism at least attempted to create, for the Maya continued to produce for an interdependent market economy, as they had before the Spanish came, with the Spanish overlords simply exacting tribute and services. The economy created by the Spaniards was by no means classic capitalism, where there were government-imposed economic controls and monopolies, as well as prohibitions against trade with foreign countries. Moreover, the Spanish elite did not depend for its wealth on the making of profit from the economy so much as in using the government to gain privileges that translated into economic gain, whether from direct extractions from the Indians or from privileges in the acquisition of land or monopolies. The small Spanish community and the still smaller Spanish elite facilitated interlocking political, economic, religious, family, and social institutions, which in turn facilitated the kinds of corruption and abuses that flourished in colonial Latin America and continued to do so long after the colonial era was over. The Aztecs. The peoples called generically Aztecs by the Spaniards who arrived in the Valley of Mexico in the early 16th century were an amalgamation of various peoples, known collectively among the indigenous people themselves as the Mexica. The Mexica had moved repeatedly over a period of more than 200 years, from the early 12th century to the mid-14th century, before finally settling down in the Valley of Mexico. They were not strictly nomadic, however, for they stopped for varying numbers of years at various sites, practicing agriculture as well as hunting and fishing, before moving on. Often old people were abandoned to their fate as the Mexica resumed their treks to new locations. As in the rest of the hemisphere, there were no wheeled vehicles or draft animals that could carry those who could not make the journey on foot through the rugged mountainous terrain. What is called the Valley of Mexico is in fact a mountain basin covering 25,000 square miles of fertile land. Despite being in the tropics, the climate is not tropical because of its altitude of 7,000 feet, which produces mild days and cool nights. Here, an earlier civilization had arisen, that of the Toltec Empire. The Mexica may have been one of the outlying vassal peoples of the Toltecs, and, like some other such peoples, may have begun migrating in the wake of the collapse of that empire after barbarian attacks. The Mexica themselves have been characterized as semi-civilized, as of the time of their movement toward the site where they were later to develop their own civilization. When they finally settled down in the Valley of Mexico in the 12th century, there were already villages and even cities there, established by a variety of other peoples in a situation characterized as a scene of almost Balkan complexity and flux, with fleeting and shifting alliances marked by betrayals. The newly arriving Mexica found themselves surrounded by innumerable peoples, of whom none showed goodwill toward them. In this precarious natural and human situation, the Mexica submitted as vassals to one of the stronger groups in the area, the Kulwa, who permitted them to settle in a barren region where their chances of survival seemed slim. As vassals, the Mexica joined the Kulwa in a successful war against one of the many other peoples in the region. But the military prowess shown by the Mexica during these battles alarmed their masters, who planned to annihilate them as a potential rival or menace. When these plans were betrayed to the Mexica, they moved once more, out into an island in a nearby lagoon. Here, eventually, they established their capital city of Tenochtitlan, destined ultimately to become the capital of the Aztec Empire. However, the Mexica or Aztecs were to pass through many vicissitudes before that happened. There were natural advantages and disadvantages of the location of the settlement of Tenochtitlan. Being in a lagoon, it had the advantage of freeing the Aztecs from the danger of surprise attacks, since they could see any attackers before they could arrive across the water. Enclosing local inlets and canals, much like Venice, Tenochtitlan also had the great economic advantage of water transport, especially important in a region of the world without pack animals, draft animals, or wheeled vehicles, where the alternative means of transporting goods and resources was by the much more costly method of human porterage. Both plants and animals were plentiful to supply food, but the Aztecs were entirely dependent upon the surrounding peoples for their supplies of both wood and stone. However, they were able to trade their marine products to acquire the wood and stone they needed. Over time, the Aztecs developed economically, culturally, politically, and militarily. Long required to pay tribute to the powerful Tepanecs, they reacted to increased exactions by forming an alliance with another tributary people to rebel against their powerful overlords. The death of the Tepanecs' wily ruler, Tezozomoc, and the rise of the great Aztec leader Montezuma set the stage for a dramatic confrontation between the two peoples. Tezozomoc's son and successor was far less subtle and provoked more enemies, leading ultimately to a war that led to his own death and the downfall of the Tepanec domination of the Aztecs and others. For many of these other subject peoples, however, the ascendancy of the Aztecs meant that they had simply changed masters, as the Aztecs now began to demand and receive tribute on an ever larger scale. The Aztec Empire was a confederation of city-states that was only about a century old when the Spaniards encountered it in the 16th century. While the city-state of Tenochtitlan dominated this confederation, the Aztecs ruled through existing authorities among the various subject people, rather than by appointing their own viceroys over them. There was no imperial standing army, but military expeditions could be organized from the male population for punitive expeditions against those who disobeyed or rebelled. The effectiveness of such methods of indirect rule tended to vary with the distance from the center of the empire, with outlying regions being more likely to disobey or rebel. Although the areas over which the Aztecs exerted varying degrees of control extended beyond the Valley of Mexico and eventually stretched from the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific, there were also independent peoples living within that amorphous orbit, as well as subject peoples of varying degrees of submission. One of the first tasks of a new Aztec ruler was often to lead military expeditions to reassert the authority of the empire over nominally subject peoples. Internally, the Aztecs developed a politically complex society, with great urban centers, many technical advances, and a fierce military tradition. They also built aqueducts, canals, drawbridges, and agricultural terraces, as well as building huge and elaborate stone monuments in their cities. Like other Western Hemisphere cultures, the Aztecs did not have a written language, but they came close to having one in their pictographs depicting their history and their way of life. Among the many skills used in Tenochtitlan were those of the conquered peoples, such as the Mixtecs, who were renowned as craftsmen who produced gold ornaments used by Aztec nobles. Hernán Cortés, leader of the first Spanish conquistadores to encounter the Aztecs, described an Aztec nobleman's two-story home in which he was a guest as being as good as the best in Spain, both for its stonework and its woodwork. The Aztec rise to ascendancy over other peoples and to technological and cultural ascendancy was accompanied by the development of an increasingly hierarchical society internally. The ruler's disposition of huge amounts of tribute pouring in from the subject peoples enhanced his power over his own people, to whom this tribute was distributed as largesse. Eventually, the ruler's role developed to such godlike dimensions that merely to look him directly in the eye was an offense punishable by death. The royal succession was not hereditary, but noble leaders chose each new ruler from among the royal princes on the basis of perceived fitness for the role. These noble classes, including priests, were set apart from the masses by laws which restricted the wearing of cotton clothing and jewels, as well as the eating of particular sumptuous foods and the drinking of cocoa, to this class, with violations of these taboos also being punishable by death. At the bottom of the hierarchy were the slaves, typically used as domestic servants or as substitutes for pack animals. Slavery was not hereditary, but was sufficiently widespread that slave traders were among the most prosperous people in the Aztec Empire, and there was even a specialized occupation of bathing slaves so that they would be made suitable to be human sacrifices. Above all, the Aztec Empire was one in which military prowess was emphasized and glorified. For an Aztec warrior, one of the great prizes of war were the captured enemy warriors who were led back to the capital to be sacrificed by having their hearts cut out of their living bodies on a high altar, while Aztec civilians and foreign emissaries watched as streams of blood poured down the steps of the pyramid from this mass carnage. Rulers and dignitaries from the surrounding peoples, both subjects and independent peoples, were not merely invited but compelled to attend, a decline of the invitation being punishable by death. The number of people sacrificed on the altars of the various pyramids has been a matter of dispute among scholars, but the competing estimates are in the tens of thousands. The particular Aztec warrior who had captured an enemy was not only allowed the honor of cutting his heart out, but was also awarded an arm or thigh to take home and cook for a ceremonial meal for his family. The purpose of this was not to provide food, but to fulfill cultural and religious purposes, just as the purpose of the public sacrifice was to propitiate the gods and to inure the Aztec people in general to blood and carnage. For the conquered peoples, their ordeal began immediately after conquest. When the Aztecs conquered the Mixtecs, their ruler was killed and his family enslaved. Then their chiefs, who submitted to Aztec rule, had to attend a victory banquet at which the Aztecs boasted of their feats and hurled humiliating insults at the vanquished. Thereafter, tribute in kind and in labor had to be paid to the Aztecs. This tribute sometimes included children to be sacrificed on the altars. Many conquered peoples were reduced to being serfs tied to land controlled by their Aztec overlords. An even worse fate could await conquered areas that later rebelled, which could lead to a wholesale slaughter of the population. Wanton brutality was not the whole story, however. The Aztecs, like such other conquerors as the Mongols, used terror as a weapon to demoralize their enemies and keep the subjugated peoples in line. Aztec leaders were often shrewdly scheming politicians, both in dealing with external peoples or with various rivals and allies within the empire. Meanwhile, as of the beginning of the 16th century, the Spaniards had established permanent colonies in the Caribbean, on the islands of Hispaniola and Cuba, and many Spanish explorers were beginning to survey the mainland of North and South America. Among these were Amerigo Vespucci, from whom the name America was derived, and Núñez de Balboa, who was the first European to see the ocean whose peaceful appearance so contrasted with the Atlantic that he named it the Pacific Ocean. Some early Spanish expeditions were able to establish friendly relations with the Indians on the mainland, exchanging glass beads, which were a novelty to the Indians, for gold. Other expeditions, however, ran into trouble. Spaniards who landed on the Yucatan Peninsula in 1517 to get water were attacked by Mayans and barely made it back to the ship, after losing dozens of men and having their captain killed. For the Aztecs, however, the fateful landing was that of Hernan Cortes in 1519, commanding 500 soldiers and 100 sailors. By this time, the Aztecs were ruled by Montezuma II, grandson of the founder of the empire. He had been receiving reports of strange men from the sea, long before he actually saw the Spaniards, and was puzzled and troubled as to what this might mean, particularly in view of Aztec concerns with signs and portents. Meanwhile, Cortes and his men landed on the Yucatan Peninsula, avoiding the area where the previous Spanish expedition had encountered Mayans 2 years earlier. Still, they too became embattled with local Indians. This time, however, the Spaniards won decisively, using their horses, firearms, and military tactics, all of which were at this point unknown to the native people. In a token of submission, the Indian chiefs gave the Spaniards food, clothing, gold, and young women, one of whom became not only the consort of Cortes and bore him a son, but also became a confidant and learned Spanish, making her invaluable as a translator. As Cortes's expedition had contacts with other groups of Indians, he heard of Montezuma II and expressed a wish to meet him. Although Montezuma was far more powerful than the other Indians who had attacked the Spaniards, he decided not to oppose them immediately, but to meet with them and find out more. He sent gifts to the Spaniards, including a gold disc described as being as large as a cartwheel, and a silver disc of the same size, the two apparently representing the sun and the moon, respectively. Shortly after meeting with emissaries from Montezuma, Cortes received orders from the governor of Cuba to return there. But, having heard of the fabulous wealth of the Aztecs, and having seen the gold and silver presents, Cortes not only disobeyed his orders, but also burned the ship, to eliminate any thoughts of returning among the men under his command. The expedition proceeded on toward the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan, winning a devastating victory over another Indian people on the way, a victory reported back to Montezuma by spies. The Spaniards' military superiority derived from their horses, the first the Indians had ever seen, their armor that was impervious to Indian weapons, and their cannon, all coordinated by highly developed military tactics which emphasized group maneuvers rather than individual fighting feats, such as those of the Indians. At this point in history, Spanish troops were among the finest fighting forces in Europe, and their equipment among the best. They repeatedly defeated much larger numbers of Indians. News of the Spaniards' military prowess attracted other Indians who allied themselves with them, whether to share in the spoils or to avenge the oppressions their people had suffered from the Aztecs. On their way toward the Aztec capital, the Spaniards encountered the Chaloyans, allies of the Aztecs who were pressured by Montezuma's emissaries to invite the Spaniards into their city and then to ambush them. However, an informer betrayed this plot to the Spaniards, who turned the tables and struck first, killing the Chiloyan leaders who stood out in the city square to greet them as part of the ambush plot. When word of this turn of events reached Montezuma, he became even less willing to risk his army on an open battlefield against the Spaniards, hoping instead to be able to fight in more favorable terrain within the island city of Tenochtitlan. Later, when the Spaniards arrived, he welcomed Cortes into the capital city and exchanged gifts with him, both men making friendly overtures and waiting for an opportunity to strike. By now, Cortes had with him not only 500 Spaniards, but also 2,000 to 3,000 Indian warriors. However, these forces were now inside an island city of at least 250,000 inhabitants, the capital of an empire with even more military forces available elsewhere. In this highly dangerous situation, the Spaniards exhibited one of the characteristics that was to be a key to their successes throughout the hemisphere: audacity in the face of danger. After 2 weeks as guests in Tenochtitlan, Cortes and his most trusted captains sought an audience with Montezuma under a pretext. Once inside the imperial compound, they then seized the ruler of the Aztecs as a hostage. Now he walked across the plaza to the quarters of the Spaniards, both pretending that this was just a friendly visit. However, as the months passed, with Montezuma still in captivity, it became transparent to all that he had become a captive and a puppet of the Spaniards. Eventually, he openly declared himself a vassal of King Charles V of Spain. Meanwhile, the Spanish governor of Cuba, whom Cortes had disobeyed, dispatched a new contingent of Spanish troops with orders to arrest the mutinous leader. Again displaying great audacity, Cortes went out to ambush the leader of this contingent and then persuaded these new troops to join him and his men in the city of Tenochtitlan. The arrival of Spanish reinforcements sufficiently alarmed the Aztecs that they now began to assemble troops for an assault on the foreigners' quarters. However, Montezuma was made to climb atop a parapet and dissuade the troops from any action. By now, however, Montezuma had lost the respect of other Aztec leaders, who considered it a warrior leader's duty to die rather than betray his country to save his own life. Another monarch was chosen, Montezuma's brother, who had advocated fighting the Spaniards from the outset. However, he lived less than 3 months, dying of smallpox that was sweeping through Mexico as a result of the Europeans' presence. In this highly volatile situation, the Spaniards precipitated a crisis that cost many of them their lives by their contempt for the Aztec religion and their insistence on trying to install the symbols of Christianity in Aztec places of worship. When the Aztecs gathered to celebrate one of their religious occasions, the Spaniards entered the temple courtyard and proceeded to attack the religious leaders. Then they surrounded those who danced, whereupon they went among the drums. Then they struck the arms of one who beat the drums. They severed both his hands, and afterwards struck his neck, so that his head flew off, rolling far away. Then they pierced them all with iron lances, and they struck each with iron swords. Of some they slashed open the back, and then the entrails gushed out. Of some they split the head. They hacked their heads to pieces. While such savagery was not uncommon when the Aztecs conquered other peoples and destroyed their religious idols, it was deeply shocking to be on the receiving end, shocking not only in human terms, but also in religious terms, to a people to whom religion was as important and held with as much intolerant bigotry as among the Spaniards. The sacrilege and the carnage marked a point of no return in relations between the invaders and the Aztecs, a point beyond which all polite or devious pretenses were dropped and open warfare became inevitable. Another armed assault on the Spanish stronghold was launched, and this time Montezuma's words failed to stop it. He died in the battle that followed, though it is not clear whether he was killed by Aztecs or by Spaniards. Desperate fighting ensued, in which the Spaniards gained the upper hand for the moment, setting fire to the sacred temple of the Aztecs and sending idols hurtling down its steps, to the horror of the populace. However, Cortes knew that he and his men would have to try to escape under cover of night. An alarm was given by women who spotted them, and another carnage followed, with the Aztecs gaining the upper hand this time, and the Spaniards and their Indian allies desperately fleeing across the existing bridges and over a floating bridge which they had constructed. Many of the Spaniards were so laden with gold that they could not escape. However, the Aztecs' emphasis on capturing prisoners for sacrifice and collecting booty especially exotic Spanish weapons in this case, allowed Cortes and many of his Spanish troops and Indian allies to escape in the night. Had there been a simple race war for the Western Hemisphere at that time, the position of the Spaniards would have been hopeless, for they had not only lost many men and horses, but also their firearms. Yet they were not only sheltered by Indians opposed to the Aztecs, but were also able to line up more Indian allies in the months that followed. Meanwhile, news of the Aztecs' great hoards of gold and silver attracted more Spanish adventurers by the shiploads. Within a year, Cortes was able to lead another and more powerful army of Spaniards and Indians in another assault on the Aztec capital. On his way back, he encountered both resistance and collaboration, as well as circumspect neutrality from different Indian communities along the way, depending upon those communities' prior relations with the Aztecs. The new army marching on Tenochtitlan included 900 Spaniards and thousands of Indians. After a siege that left the population inside the city starving and racked by disease, the invaders stormed in. Again, there was desperate fighting, with the tide of battle shifting back and forth. Finally, the Spaniards received the surrender of the military commander with respect, but they were unable to prevent their Indian allies from taking vengeance against the Aztecs with a wholesale slaughter of the city's population, dining later on the limbs of those they had killed, as so many of their people had been eaten by the Aztecs. So great was the carnage that the stench of the rotting bodies made Cortes sick. The hunger that had prevailed in the besieged city was evidenced by trees stripped of their bark for food and by roots that had been dug up to be eaten. Thus ended the empire of the Aztecs. The Incas. In pre-Columbian times, the Inca Empire was one of the largest empires in the world, and possibly the largest of all. At its zenith, this empire stretched more than 2,000 miles from north to south, spreading over most or all of what is today Peru, Ecuador, Chile, and Bolivia, much of Colombia, and parts of Argentina and Venezuela. In climatic terms, it reached from just north of the equator to nearly the 35th parallel of southern latitude, well into the temperate zone. The heart of the empire was in the tropics, but thousands of feet above sea level, so that it suffered neither the enervating tropical heat nor the debilitating tropical diseases which plague other societies at the same latitudes. The climate and the crops, such as potatoes and other tubers, as well as maize, meant that large quantities of food could be stored, again, unlike food in much of the tropics elsewhere, and these large stores of food in turn provided the basis for a large army that could spread over vast areas and yet be fed from widely scattered storehouses. The geographic setting of the Inca Empire was highly varied in temperature, rainfall, and other natural characteristics. Because of the great vertical distances in the mountainous terrain, temperatures ranged from tropical at the lowest elevations to too cold for many crops to grow at the highest elevations. What this meant was that there was great variation in the plants and animals which thrived at different elevations within a relatively small area as the crow flies. This also meant that there were very different ways of life among various peoples who were farmers, fishermen, pastoralists, and other specialists adapted to very different environments which were not very far from one another in the horizontal plane, however separated they might be vertically. Because the water in the region derived ultimately from the westward flowing winds from the Atlantic Ocean, there was far more rainfall on the eastern jungles and uplands than in the Andean mountains, which intercepted enough of the remaining moisture in the air to leave the narrow Pacific coastal lands very arid. Although we speak loosely of the people of that empire as Incas, more strictly, the Inca was the title of the ruler, and more generally of the nobility, approximately 40,000 people who ruled the millions of others in the empire. These others included conquered peoples of various ethnic, cultural, and linguistic backgrounds, and of varying degrees of loyalty and reliability as far as the empire was concerned. Like their Ottoman contemporaries, the Inca rulers often relocated large numbers of people in order to populate recently conquered territories with politically reliable groups and disperse others to reduce the danger of insurrections. The imperial race were the Quechua-speaking people who lived in the Andean mountains at the heart of the Inca Empire, and who spread their hegemony outward and downward to lower elevations, to peoples with very different ways of life. Such natural and human variety in relative proximity fostered trade and other interactions, including conquest. As in other parts of the world, the mountain people, the Incas, were particularly well adapted for fighting. But they were much more than just warriors. Culturally, the Incas were among the most advanced of the indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere. They built in stone, both cities and monuments, and had a system of accounting using multicolored strings with knots in a system somewhat similar to the abacus in China. Their great buildings included houses with halls 200 yards long and 50 to 60 yards wide, where great festivals were held indoors during bad weather. The highway system connecting the vast Incan Empire was tens of thousands of miles long and has been considered one of the best all-weather highways built before the appearance of the automobile. The hilly and mountainous terrain along the west coast of South America where the Incas reigned contained relatively little flat arable land, and so required terraced agriculture to retain the precious water. Canals and other devices were also used to control the flow and use of water. As in other parts of the world, terraces and canals required large-scale organization of people, and these in turn required a power capable of controlling and directing such large numbers of people. The degree of individualism possible among the Plains Indians of North America, for example, was incompatible with survival in a setting where coping with the natural environment required large-scale projects. Inca society was very hierarchical within itself, quite aside from its dominance over the subjugated peoples of the empire, some of whom were used as human sacrifices in their religious rituals. Like most of the Indian nations of the Western Hemisphere, the Incas had no written language, so that much of what is known about their history before the Spanish conquests has had to be reconstructed from archaeological evidence. Although there was a written version of the Spanish language, most of the early conquistadores were illiterate, including their leader, Francisco Pizarro, so that there were few, if any, contemporary written accounts of the Incas, even as they existed at the moment of their first contact with the European world, and verbal accounts of earlier times often conflicted, as verbal accounts tend to do elsewhere. However, because the Incas built so much in stone and created many objects of metal, including gold and silver, the surviving ruins and artifacts preserve a major part of the past, while such modern techniques as carbon dating permit time sequences to be reconstructed. What the Incas lacked, in addition to writing, was the wheel and the arch. They used logs as rollers to move large stones, but not wheels on an axis, which would have been of less use than elsewhere in the world because of the mountainous terrain and the absence of strong animals like horses or oxen. Either llamas or human porters were used to carry loads. Despite a lack of arches, the Incas were able to construct doorways and a variety of bridges, including suspension bridges. Despite the vast extension of the Incan Empire and the ancient culture of the region, neither the empire nor the state from which it sprang were very long-lived in historical terms. The Incan state lasted not quite a century, and the empire little more than 50 years. In addition to uprisings among the conquered peoples, there were internal struggles for power among the Incas themselves, growing in part from a lack of clear rules of succession. However, the empire was still growing to some extent, and prior conquests were still being consolidated when Europeans first appeared on the scene in the 16th century. These Europeans consisted of about 260 Spaniards, about one-fourth of them mounted warriors and the rest foot soldiers. Amazingly, they were able to conquer the Incan Empire with its thousands of soldiers and millions of people. A remarkable confluence of circumstances led to this result. Perhaps the most remarkable of these circumstances was that the Spaniards had the audacity to make the attempt and the ruthlessness and imagination to carry it out, aided by major blunders by the rulers of the Inca people. A bloody and devastating civil war between rival claimants for the imperial throne of the Incas was going on when the Spaniards began their expeditions down the Pacific coast of South America in the early 16th century, where they stopped to raid, loot, and carry off women, as well as capturing others destined to be their servants and to learn enough Spanish to act as interpreters. Stories of their depredations reached both Incan rivals, the brothers Atahualpa and Huascar, sons of the recently deceased emperor, as well as others among the peoples of the Inca Empire. This provoked much speculation about the nature of these bearded men who lived in a house in the sea and rode strange new creatures, horses. Some wondered if they might be something supernatural and the fulfillment of prophecies in the Incan religion. Messages were exchanged between the Spaniards and the warring factions of Incas, both the Indians and the Europeans trying to feel their way through an uncertain situation. Meanwhile, battles between the rival Incan military forces of Huascar and Atahualpa raged on, while various political machinations were afoot. Huascar had himself declared emperor in the Incan capital of Cuzco, but Atahualpa's army from Quito, Ecuador, marched relentlessly southward toward the capital, eventually capturing Huascar and instituting a mass slaughter of the Inca nobles there, accompanied by hideous atrocities against the population in general. But soon after Atahualpa vanquished his rival for control of the empire, the Spaniards also followed the roads into Cusco. The first blunder of the new Inca ruler was to underestimate the fighting ability of the Spaniards by preferring to believe the disdainful accounts of their early battles in the lowlands by some of his advisors, rather than the eyewitness testimony of those who had actually fought the Spaniards. Flush from his own recent military victories, Atahualpa may have been reluctant to believe that the new bearded men he had heard of were anything that he could not handle, especially since they were a small fighting force and he was not among those who believed them to be supernatural. In addition to word of the activities of the Spaniards in the lowland outskirts of the empire, word reached the emperor of devastating diseases striking and destroying the peoples of that region. Vast numbers of people were dying in Quito, for example. These diseases spread not simply from direct contact with the Europeans, for once diffused into the indigenous population, the diseases traveled wherever those people traveled, whether trading, fishing, or otherwise. Therefore, as the Europeans advanced militarily, they often encountered populations already weakened or devastated by their diseases. So it was in the heartland of the Incas. Unknown to anyone at the time, those who brought news of the new diseases also inadvertently brought the diseases as well. So did the Incan armies recalled from the stricken areas. People were dying of European diseases in the Incan capital before the first white man was ever seen there. Meanwhile, the Spaniards, having gained victories over the lowland peoples and having looted them, proceeded on up toward the highland heart of the Inca Empire, whose treasures of gold they had heard so much about. Increasingly impressed by the obviously advanced civilization they saw around them, and then terrified by the size of the army they saw, they invited the Inca emperor to join them for dinner and to have them pay homage to him, as they sought desperately for a way to get out of the predicament in which they now found themselves. The second and critical blunder of Atahualpa, perhaps based on his first, the underestimation of the Spaniards, was to agree to meet with Pizarro and his men at their encampment. Following carefully laid plans, concealed Spaniards ambushed and captured Atahualpa, using their cannons and horses to spread confusion and terror among the large but lightly armed body of troops accompanying the Inca. Indians by the thousands were slaughtered within a matter of hours. Precisely because the Incan Empire was very hierarchical and well organized, the capture of its ruler gave the Spaniards enormous leverage over the whole realm. But first, they used the captured emperor to extract vast sums of gold and silver as ransom. The gold received as his ransom has been estimated as being worth more than $6 million in late 20th century dollars. Nevertheless, Atahualpa was not released, and eventually the Spaniards had him killed. Meanwhile, his rival Huascar was killed by Atahualpa's followers. Finally, the general in charge of Atahualpa's army was persuaded by the honeyed words of a Spanish emissary that the Inca wanted to see him, and so went to the Spaniards' encampment, where he too was captured and, in due course, killed. With much of the top leadership of both Indian factions now dead, killed by one another or by the Spaniards, the latter were now in a better position to proceed on to the capital at Cuzco. On their way, they passed a battlefield strewn with thousands of corpses of Indians killed in the Civil War. Despite the huge numerical preponderance of the remaining Incas, the Spanish soldiers enjoyed great technological superiority. It was not their guns, which were still cumbersome, slow-firing, and not very accurate at this point, but their armor, their swords, and their horses, which enabled them to take on vastly greater Incan military forces and win. Horses, for example, not only permitted devastating cavalry charges, but also often nullified the enemy's lookouts, since horses could often travel faster than word could be passed from the lookouts to warn their leaders and comrades of the Spaniards' approach. Moreover, the conquistadores were full-time seasoned warriors, while much of the Incan army consisted of people who were farmers or who worked at other non-military tasks ordinarily, and who were then mobilized on particular occasions for military duty. Finally, uprisings against the Incan Empire by many of the subjugated peoples added to the confusion and uncertainty of the situation. In these circumstances, the Spaniards entered the Incan capital of Cusco, welcomed as liberators by its long-suffering inhabitants, a misconception initially encouraged by the Spaniards themselves. Time, however, would later reveal the bitter reality of the situation. The Spaniards who entered Cusco, ostensibly as liberators, and who set up a puppet Inca emperor, soon revealed themselves as the real power. The looting of the territory, the forced labor of the Indian men, and the sexual exploitation of the Indian women became widespread. From Cusco, the reconquest of the disintegrating Incan Empire by the Spaniards began, aided by large numbers of Incan troops led by the new ruler, Manco Inca. Despite fierce resistance by many of the Indian tribes, the Spanish military superiority proved repeatedly to be decisive against even the bravest and most desperate resistance. In some cases, Indian tribes who had suffered under Atahualpa's army from Quito now helped the Spaniards and the Incas from Cusco. Meanwhile, back in Cusco itself, the Spanish were on relatively good behavior pending the arrival of new reinforcements of Spaniards from Spanish colonies farther north. Numerous shiploads of Spaniards then arrived, seeking the fabled riches of Peru. Many were given custody of thousands of Indians, whose tribute and labor in the mines made the Spaniards rich. Even some Spaniards who had been peasants or artisans now became part of a wealthy ruling class, to whom such things as trade and manual labor were deemed socially unacceptable. As Peru was transformed into a Spanish colony, a new capital was built along the coast, making it more accessible by ship to other Spanish colonies and to Spain, and ending the need for slow and costly porterage of supplies up into the mountainous region around Cusco. The new colonial capital ultimately became modern Peru's capital, Lima. After the Quitan army that had come south with Atahualpa was forced back to its homeland and crushed there by the Spaniards and the military forces of the Inca, the Spanish Empire was now secure enough for its exploitation to proceed in disregard of the Indians, including the Inca and the Incan nobility who had collaborated with them. It was said that no woman who was good-looking was safe to her husband. But, although the Spaniards had many native girls as mistresses, they seldom married them, waiting for women from Spain to arrive, now that the conquered land was secure. The arrogance of the Spaniards eventually reached the point where the Inca's own sister was raped, and then his wife was taken away by one of the Pizarros. The Inca's protests caused him to be imprisoned, then humiliated both privately and publicly. He escaped from Cusco and went into the mountains, from which he conducted armed resistance to the Spaniards for years and roused widespread rebellions among the Indians. Various groups of Indians for 1,000 miles around arose in rebellion against the Spaniards. The battles, skirmishes, and guerrilla actions raged on for years, with brutalities and atrocities being common on both sides. However, some of the Indians, once subjugated by the Incas, fought on the side of the Spaniards or helped them with information or supplies. Nor were the Spaniards always united. The arrival of large new contingents of Spanish troops changed the balance of power in favor of the newcomers, who were anxious to claim riches and power such as their predecessors had already acquired. Moreover, the newcomers had been sent by royal command after the King of Spain had become disgusted with reports of the disgraceful behavior of Pizarro's men in Peru. A civil war then ensued among the Spaniards, during which Gonzalo Pizarro had 340 Spaniards executed and then ended up being executed himself when the royal forces triumphed. Although the triumph of the royalist faction brought royal decrees seeking better treatment of the Indians, the kings of Spain vacillated between humanitarian concerns aroused by the reports of mistreatment brought to them by both clerical and lay observers from South America, and a desire to continue receiving the vast amounts of gold and silver extracted from the ground and from the natives, and which was flowing into Spain in general and into the royal coffers in particular. The result was a series of weakly enforced attempts to stop the worst abuses, together with an acquiescence in the general system in which individual Spaniards had control of thousands of Indians each, and did with them largely what they wished. The appointment of Don Francisco de Toledo as viceroy in 1568 marked an attempt at both reforming the Spaniards and converting the Indians to Christianity and to a European way of life. More than 1.5 million Indians were forcibly relocated from their scattered hillside communities to towns created for the purpose of changing their way of life, both religiously and socially. Spanish clergymen sought out and destroyed Indian religious objects, including the mummies of Incan emperors, and leaders of the indigenous religions were caught and flogged. Dictionaries were created for the Quechua language. These attempts to remake the Indians in the image of the Spaniards met resistance, evasion, flight, and even armed uprisings, in which Christian churches were destroyed and their symbols smashed. In the end, the Spaniards prevailed, at least in the sense of having political control of the country and effective control of most of the indigenous population, many of whom were worked mercilessly in the silver mines and elsewhere to enrich individual Spaniards and the Spanish government, both in Spain and in the colonies. The Incan Empire was destroyed as thoroughly as the Roman Empire had been destroyed. Moreover, the preservation of some parts of Roman culture by a relatively few educated men, mostly clergy, in medieval Europe, allowed at least a thin strain of continuity. Because the Incan culture had no written language, even this much preservation was not possible. The complex culture of the Incans could not be sustained in the socially fragmented world of the post-conquest Indians. One sign of this were the large terraced lands which were subsequently abandoned, even though the stone-faced terraces themselves remained as ruins on into the 20th century. These terraces were part of a way of life no longer feasible without the cultural continuity and political hegemony on which it depended. North America. The numerous Indian tribes, nations, and confederations spread across the vast North American continent differed not only among themselves, but differed in general from the Aztecs and the Incas. By and large, the Indians of North America did not have as hierarchical or as despotic governments as those of the Aztecs and Incas, or the governments of contemporary Europeans. Indeed, questions have been raised as to whether the ways in which many North American Indians organized their collective activities should be called government at all, for chiefs might be chosen for particular purposes, such as conducting a hunt or a war, without the individuals chosen having any permanent power to dictate to their people, or perhaps even to remain in authority beyond the duration of the activity for which they were chosen. Relationships among North American Indian tribes and nations seldom involved such grinding oppression as that imposed on those conquered by the Aztecs or Incas. Nevertheless, the stronger tribes or nations collected tribute from the weaker, as was common around the world, and, in confederacies such as those of the Iroquois, some tribes played subordinate roles while others took the lead. This does not imply that harmonious or even humane relationships always existed among North American Indians, for archaeological evidence exists of both torture and cannibalism in the pre-Columbian era. Cherokees enslaved other Indians, and, after the European settlers arrived, sold some of them to the whites, as they would later buy and sell African slaves, or return runaway slaves to whites for the rewards. North American Indians also tended not to be nearly as urbanized as the Aztecs or the Incas, nor to have such large concentrations of wealth as attracted the conquistadores. Nor were there such large concentrations of people. The entire Cherokee Nation in 1690 consisted of about 20,000 people, even though the Cherokees were one of the largest tribes east of the Mississippi. There were more Maya than this in and around Tikal alone, and more Aztecs than this in their capital city of Tenochtitlan. Perhaps most important of all, the relationship between the Indians and the early European settlers tended to be very different from what they were in Latin America. During the colonial era, and to some extent beyond, the story of British, French, Dutch, and Swedish settlement and expansion on the North American mainland was quite different from that of the Spanish and Portuguese conquests in the rest of the hemisphere. As a leading authority on North American Indian history put it, Loose talk of the conquest of the Indians has obscured the fact that Indians relinquished much jurisdictional territory by negotiated voluntary cession, appearing in the form of sale of property. Not only was much land acquired this way during the colonial era, so was much land acquired after the colonies became the United States of America. This is not to say that no chicanery or force was ever involved, but simply that this was not a classic conquest, as exemplified by the Spanish or Portuguese conquests, or by the conquests of nations in Europe. The difference between the way the Iberians acquired land during the colonial era and the way the British, French, Dutch, and Swedes acquired land reflected in part differences in the relative strength of Europeans and Indians in the different regions of the hemisphere. In turn, this reflected differences in the initial settlers from different parts of Europe and differing natural conditions in North America. Because the Indians of the Atlantic seaboard, where the British, French, Dutch, and Swedes initially settled, had no such immense concentrations of wealth as those of the more advanced Aztec or Incan empires, there was nothing to attract shiploads of fighting men in search of booty. The earliest attractions of North America were the rich fishing banks off Newfoundland and the availability of animal hides and furs on a vast scale no longer seen in Europe. Fishing vessels from Britain, France, Spain, and Portugal plied the waters, but the furs were best obtained by trading with the Indians. Thus, a series of trading posts began to appear on shores and along rivers, such as the Hudson and the St. Lawrence, which reached far into the interior and were deep enough for ocean-going ships. Quebec alone shipped 30,000 pelts to Europe in 1630. The Dutch, the paramount maritime nation of the time, preferred outposts and settlements on islands, which were more defensible against attack. For them, Manhattan was an ideal site on a navigable waterway that extended hundreds of miles inland, so it was here that they established the settlement they called New Amsterdam. Farther upriver, they established Fort Orange as a trading post, where the city of Albany is located today. Other European powers, principally France and Britain, likewise began establishing outposts and settlements along the eastern seaboard. Their chief rivalry was among themselves, rather than with the Indians, who were anxious to trade with the newcomers for products of European industry, ranging from cooking utensils to firearms. Unlike the troops of the conquistadores, the earliest European settlers on the eastern seaboard of North America included women and children, and the total numbers of people in these settlements were often too small to be regarded as a threat by the surrounding Indian nations. In the mid-17th century, for example, the entire French population of New France consisted of only 300 people, scattered in four tiny settlements along the St. Lawrence River, and the population of New Sweden never reached 400. Even some larger settlements had very precarious beginnings, such as the Virginia settlement along the James River, which began with 6,000 people and declined over years of hardship and hunger to a population of 1,200. With the passage of time, however, larger and more formidable European settlements appeared, both from the growth of some existing settlements and by the establishment of new colonies. New France had a population of more than 3,000 people by 1663, and nearly 11,000 by 1685. Over the decades from 1630 to 1660, approximately 20,000 Puritans came to North America. By mid-century, there were 10,000 Europeans in Newfoundland, two-thirds of them Irish Catholics, and New Amsterdam also had 10,000 people when the British seized it from the Dutch in 1664. Even these later populations may seem small, but they must be compared to the contemporary populations of individual Indian tribes in North America, especially since these tribes were by no means united in opposition to white settlers. Meanwhile, the spread of European diseases decimated the Indians with whom they were in contact, accentuating the shift in the local population balance and in the corresponding military balance of power, a balance which affected their relations and negotiations, even when there were no actual clashes in battle. Moreover, the smaller Indian populations remaining after epidemics of European diseases required less land, so that tribes were able to trade this land, much of it already cultivated, to the European settlers, to whom such land was more valuable than a wilderness that they would have to clear and cultivate from scratch. The decimation of tribes living near Europeans by disease also affected their balance of power with other tribes living farther away, and therefore less subject to epidemics of European diseases. Thus, while a staggering 90% of the Wampanoag tribe in New England died of European diseases, these diseases had no such impact on the Mi'kmaq tribe of hunters and gatherers who had less contact with whites, and who now began raiding the stricken Wampanoag communities, which also found themselves forced to cede land to the Narragansett tribe. Where the opportunities presented themselves, some white settlers not only took Indian land, but also captured Indians individually or in groups for sale as slaves, many being traded to the Spaniards or to the West Indies. Such depredations in New England provoked much hostility toward Europeans in parts of the region, years before the Pilgrims landed and established a settlement at Plymouth in 1620. Having heard of the Indian hostility before landing, the Pilgrims approached them in a belligerent posture, provoking more hostility. Thus, although the new colonists were saved from starvation by the corn found in deserted Indian cornfields, their relationships with the Indians began shakily. However, they were able to negotiate a treaty in 1621 with some of the local Indians, though apparently under the misapprehension that they had gained peace with all the Indians. Although classic government-to-government warfare and conquest were not the norm between Indians and whites in colonial North America, fighting on the frontiers was not only common, but ferocious and brutal. Where Indians captured whites, for example, they took delight in dashing white children against tree trunks or scalping or dismembering them in front of their anguished parents, among the many other sadistic tortures they practiced. White settlers, in turn, wiped out whole Indian communities and offered bounties for Indian scalps. Whatever the relations among white and Indian leaders, along the disputed frontiers, bitter hatred and unbridled savagery were mutual. Alongside these bitter and implacable hatreds and hostilities between some whites and Indians, there developed trading relationships and military alliances between other whites and other Indians. British colonial officials, and later American leaders, often took a paternalistic view of the Indians, as did missionaries, but these were views seldom shared by pioneers confronting Indians on the frontier. Thus, while Quaker leaders in Philadelphia viewed the Indians benignly, honored treaties with them and gave them gifts, the Scotch-Irish settlers on the western Pennsylvania frontier fought the Indians as mercilessly as the Indians fought them. Farther north, Dartmouth College provided financial aid for Indian students to attend, but Lord Jeffrey Amherst, for whom another college would later be named, not only fought the Indians militarily, but even tried deliberately to spread smallpox among them. Relationships and policies between whites and Indians had neither consistency among people nor consistency over time on either side. Nevertheless, there were some general patterns. While the white settlers' military strength grew with the growth of the European population and the decline in the populations of the surrounding Indian tribes, what the Europeans had from the beginning, and increasingly over time, were new products desired by the Indians. Woolen cloth and cloth garments were major items from Europe traded by the new arrivals to their Indian neighbors, as were firearms and ammunition. Food was initially a major item desired by the settlers, until they learned from the Indians how to grow maize, corn, and other crops in an environment that was new to them. As time went on, the settlers became self-sufficient in the basic necessities, while the massive trade in the hides, and especially the furs of animals in general, and beavers in particular, continued to grow as an international trade of major dimensions between North America and Europe, with the European settlers acting as middlemen, conveying European products to the Indians and furs to Europe. Even before Europeans began to settle in colonial North America, the fur trade was an international trade with many centuries of history behind it. Russians were prominent among the suppliers of furs, and some of the furs acquired from the Indians of North America were sent by the Dutch to Russia, where people highly skilled in preparing furs could work on them and then return them to the Netherlands for the finishing touches. The discovery of vast regions in North America where fur-bearing animals, particularly beavers, still abounded, gave an enormous impetus to this market. As a result, fur hats became such a fashion among the affluent in Europe that the wearing of caps declined until it became a sign of being a member of the lower classes. The Indians and the European settlers were not only trading partners during the colonial era, they were often also military allies, the Mohawks with the Dutch, the Hurons with the French, and later the entire Iroquois Confederacy with the British. Thus, Indians were drawn into the worldwide power struggles of the European imperial nations, as these struggles were fought out in North America. This included a series of wars between the French and the British, as well as the American War of Independence, in both of which the Indians fought largely on the losing side, costing them dearly in land ceded as part of their surrender, as well as in immediate casualties and lasting ill will. European settlers, however, were usually not drawn into local wars among the Indians, except as suppliers of firearms to one side or the other, or as power brokers. In addition to economic and military ties between the colonists and the Indians in their vicinity, there were cultural changes induced among the Indians as a result of their relations with the Europeans. Some Indians became Christians, for example, thereby creating schisms within tribes. More generally, the economic and military functions within Indian communities changed as a result of a growing reliance on trade with European settlers for the basic means of livelihood and reliance on European firearms and ammunition for hunting and for fighting wars with rival tribes. Many Indians changed their way of life, sometimes abandoning crafts which produced goods that were now more easily obtained in trade with the white settlers. Thus, the Indians in contact with whites became more dependent on whites over time, while the white settlers became less and less dependent on the Indians after learning from them how to grow the crops indigenous to North America, learning the landscape, and learning indigenous languages. A crucial factor in their changing relationship was writing, including mapmaking, which allowed any information given to the transplanted Europeans to be spread rapidly among them and to be made a permanent cultural possession by being committed to the printed page. The Indians, lacking writing, could lose valuable traditional skills permanently if just one generation failed to continue them. In short, the Indians lost some of their skills, while the European settlers kept theirs, added what they had learned from the Indians, and continued to receive new technological and other knowledge from Europe. All this contributed to a changing balance of power over time, increasingly favoring the European settlers. The various indigenous peoples fought among themselves for access to European trading posts, where beaver furs could be traded for goods from across the Atlantic. Among these goods, perhaps the most fateful, were guns and liquor. Those Indians immediately in contact with Europeans fought off other Indians trying to reach them, so that most of the furs traded to Europeans came from Indians who had not themselves trapped the animals, but who had acquired their pelts in trade from other Indians farther away in exchange for European goods supplied by the Indian middlemen, who made a profit on both exchanges. Thus, the Cree Indians on the shores of Hudson's Bay became middlemen in the fur trade, and the Iroquois, who dominated the region between the Alleghenies and the Great Lakes, cut off the Ottawas and the Hurons from Quebec and Montreal. In order to get around the Iroquois, the French ventured farther west. More than trade alone was involved. Because access to Europeans meant access to European firearms, this caused a shift in the military balance of power among Indians. The Cree Indians, for example, acquired more than 10,000 firearms from the Hudson Bay Company between 1670 and 1689, not counting the additional firearms they were getting in trade with the French. Those Indians in direct contact with white settlements could acquire enough firearms to shift the military balance of power against rival tribes and nations, whom they accordingly barred from having the same direct contact. Thus, the Ojibwa not only acquired guns, but strove to drive the Sioux and the Fox tribes away from the Great Lakes, where they too might have acquired guns. These guns could, of course, also be used against the white settlers, and often were, but a limiting factor for the Indians was that they needed the settlers not only to supply firearms, but also to repair them and to supply ammunition. In an outbreak of warfare between Indians and whites in 17th century Massachusetts, for example, the Indians won more battles, but the whites won the war when the Indians' ammunition began to run out. In general, warfare between whites and Indians was less common during the colonial era than warfare among the Indians, fighting with one another for access to European settlements. Indian tribes or nations, determined to break through rival tribes or nations who held them at bay from the European trading posts, launched attacks and invasions to gain the coveted access. The Hurons held annual meetings with other local Indians, warning them not to attempt to make direct contact with the French. Later, the Iroquois decimated the Hurons, forcing their remnants westward while absorbing some of the survivors into the Iroquois Confederation. Meanwhile, the Europeans sought better access to the Indian suppliers of pelts without having to go through middlemen. Many of the explorations of the British and the French were for the purpose of finding water routes taking them further inland to the Indians who were the original trappers, where trades could be made without paying the middleman's profit. Isolated European traders, more noted for their courage than their scruples, often penetrated deeper into Indian territory in search of better trading terms and bigger profits. Here and there, organized settlements of whites in colonial North America were able to raid or invade local Indians' territory, but usually there was no need to risk such trials of arms. Moreover, the European settlers were as anxious for the furs traded by the Indians as the Indians were for European goods. Over time, however, as the beavers began to be hunted to extinction in the eastern regions of North America, the fur trade moved west to find new beaver populations. Those Indians who had abandoned their traditional means of livelihood in favor of trade with the European settlers were left in a particularly difficult position after the loss of both hunting opportunities and of their traditional artisan skills. Where there was no such economic interdependence, as in colonial Virginia, where tobacco rather than fur was the great export, military hostilities between whites and Indians developed early on. While the first James River settlers readily traded copper for food, escalating corn prices led to forcible seizures of Indian corn and cornfields by the whites, initiating a series of wars in which hundreds were killed on each side. Unlike furs, which white settlers obtained in trade with the Indians, tobacco was grown by the colonists themselves. Although the original settlers were outnumbered by the Powhatan Indians by well over 100-1 in the early 17th century, the rapidly growing white population of Virginia was by 1675 more than 10 times the size of the Indian population. While Europeans ultimately prevailed militarily in both North and South America, this was a much more protracted process in the United States and Canada than in Latin America. Moreover, the nature of the Europeans' hegemony differed as between the Iberians, on the one hand, and the British, French, and Americans, on the other. In particular, the colonies of transplanted British and French communities in North America remained a largely insular world of their own, with Europeans living in European communities and Indians living in Indian communities, however much the boundaries between the two might move over the years, and however much interaction there might be in the frontier zones between the two. Seldom was there a situation such as that in Spanish America, where a European overlord class lived directly off the work of the indigenous peoples living in European-controlled territory. The exchange of Indian land for European goods was seldom an individual transaction. That is, individual white settlers did not usually buy land from individual Indians and go live in the midst of Indian communities. Rather, officials of the colonial settler governments purchased large tracts of land from Indian tribes and then subdivided it among individual white purchasers. Indeed, all colonial governments at one time or another banned individual land purchases from individual Indians because of the legal and other complications this could cause. Even after the white population grew larger and more powerful in colonial North America, expansion into Indian territory seldom took the classic form of conquest of one sovereign nation by another. The drive for expansion into Indian lands was often led by freelance adventurers rather than by government military forces. Under frontier conditions, even governments on the scene had only limited control of all the people nominally under their authority. As late as 1792, Thomas Jefferson wrote in a letter, "I hope, too, that your admonitions against encroachments on the Indian lands will have a beneficial effect. the U.S. finds an Indian war too serious a thing to risk incurring one merely to gratify a few intruders with settlements which are to cost the other inhabitants of the U.S. 1,000 times their value in taxes for carrying on the war they produce. I am satisfied it will ever be preferred to send armed force and make war against the intruders as being more just and less expensive. Control on the Indian side was not necessarily any more effective, in part because many North American Indians did not have the kind of governmental structures to control their own people that Europeans did. Chiefs selected to lead hunts or to lead wars had no permanent power to impose their will on the whole society. When Indian braves saw their lands invaded by whites, they could strike back and thereby unleash a war between the races, regardless of what more cautious advice might be given them by their elders. Under these circumstances of uncontrollable groups on both sides, outbreaks of frontier warfare between Europeans and Indians did not always depend on decisions made by leaders on either side. The French had a somewhat similar problem with individual entrepreneurs in the fur trade, who in effect extended the European settlements beyond bounds considered militarily defensible. In general, the expansion of the white settlers into Indian territory in North America was directed primarily toward taking over the land itself, rather than acquiring Indians as subjects of the government or as vassals of white landowners or of European ecclesiastical establishments, as happened in much of Spanish America. One consequence of this difference was that Indian and European races were much less mixed in British North America than in Spanish America, where a substantial part of the entire population was of mixed blood after 3 centuries of rule by the Spaniards. Because the advancing Europeans did not generally acquire sovereignty over the Indians living on the invaded territories, the Indians forced off these lands retreated to new lands, where their sovereignty remained more or less intact. Thus, 1 century after the United States was formed, there were still Indian nations capable of fighting the U.S. Army and of defeating Custer at the Little Bighorn. Only after the American nation spread from the Atlantic to the Pacific was federal sovereignty imposed on Indians still living in their own enclaves. The passage of time and the consolidation of European and then American government power in North America did not bring lasting peace, such as might follow a conventional conquest, for now the balance of military power shifted decisively in favor of the transplanted Europeans, whose growing populations and power meant less reason to fear wars with the Indians, as well as more reason to seek additional land for those growing populations. Thus, the 19th century saw escalating demands against the Indians and their lands in the United States, with Indian resistance leading to many new outbreaks of war, now very much along racial lines. However, even in this later period of massive European territorial expansion westward across the North American continent, Indian resistance was still not consolidated along racial lines. Rather, tribes displaced from their traditional lands by the westward movements of whites often moved west in turn themselves, invading the lands of other Indians, much in the manner of the chain reaction conquests in medieval Europe, when invaders from Central Asia pushed the Slavs ahead of them to invade East Central Europe and the Balkans. The semi-conquest, by which the United States acquired much of its land from the Indians by sales, free and forced, rather than by direct and unambiguous conquest, as in other cases, left American Indians in an anomalous legal position. On the one hand, Indians were American citizens, subject ultimately to the sovereignty of the federal government, but on the other hand, Indian nations had treaties with the United States giving them much sovereignty within their own remaining lands and creating many legal puzzles and controversies as to whether or to what extent they were subject to the laws and jurisdiction of state governments. Nor were all these anomalies laid to rest during the frontier era. As late as 1996, a federal appeals court had to decide whether a state government could impose its truck license fees on trucks operating on an Indian reservation, and the U.S. Supreme Court had to decide whether another state could apply its gambling laws on Indian reservations. Other legal issues growing out of the ambiguous process of semi-conquest and the unresolved issues of Indian sovereignty that it left continued to find their way into the courts more than 100 years after the last military battles between the Indians and federal troops. The historical patterns which emerged over the centuries in North America grew out of the geographic, demographic, and cultural circumstances of North America, rather than because the British or French were fundamentally different from the Spanish and Portuguese in their goals. In the very different circumstances of the Caribbean, where European invaders had overwhelming military superiority over the smaller and less advanced indigenous tribes of the islands, the British, French, and Dutch conquests were much more like those of the Spanish and Portuguese, both in the Caribbean and in the rest of the Western Hemisphere. The local Indians were either exterminated or subjugated, and the islands occupied by European-run plantations where African slaves produced sugar or other crops for direct export to Europe. In North America, however, the circumstances were so different as to make the European takeover a much longer and more complicated story. The Iroquois. As with many other Indian tribes, nations, and confederacies, the name by which the Iroquois became known to the European settlers was not the name they gave themselves, but a name given them by other Indians and transformed as it passed into European languages. As often happened, it was a pejorative name. The Killer People, in the language of the Algonquin Indians, subsequently transformed by Basque speakers and then transformed again as the name passed from the Basques to the French, to emerge as Iroquois, pronounced differently by the English and the French. The Iroquois were not a tribe, but a confederation, encompassing the Mohawks, the Senecas, the Cayugas, the Oneidas, and the Onondagas, and later the Tuscaroras. It was also known as the Five Nations, and then as the Six Nations, after the Tuscaroras joined in the early 18th century, spread from east to west across what is today New York State, and extending over into Canada and the northern fringe of Pennsylvania, these nations shared a family of languages used by other Indian nations, including the rival confederacy of the Huron farther west, the Susquehannock Nation to the south, and the Cherokees farther south. The Iroquois Confederation gradually took shape from a coalescing of villages, and then clusters of villages, into larger and larger political units, sometime between the middle of the 15th century and the early decades of the 16th century. This alliance formed to put an end to long and ruinous warfare among the tribes who finally came together to form the Confederation. In contrast to the autocratic rule of the Aztecs and the Incas, the Iroquois Confederation was one based on mutual agreement for any confederation-wide action, though individual nations within the Confederation might, for example, engage in war with an external enemy on its own, provided that this did not harm other member nations. In practice, however, warfare sometimes did nevertheless break out between Confederation members. Among themselves, the Iroquois were known as the People of the Longhouse, based on their distinctive dwelling places. Several nuclear families would inhabit a wooden building about 20 feet wide and more than 100 feet long, each family in its own cubicle and sharing hearths with an adjoining family. The collection of such longhouses would be surrounded by a palisade as defense against military attack. Such towns or villages might contain as many as 2,000 people, and the entire Iroquois Confederation contained perhaps 30,000 people. Located inland from the first European settlements, the Iroquois were close enough to make such contact as they needed for trading purposes, but not close enough initially to suffer the devastating epidemics of European diseases that struck other tribes adjacent to the white settlements, nor were their lands initially in immediate peril of being taken over. Moreover, the Iroquois were strong enough for the settlers to want to make peace and alliances with them. Indeed, as the Iroquois acquired firearms, they became more formidable to other Indian nations and confederacies, particularly to the Hurons and the Mohicans, both of whom were eventually devastated by wars launched by the Iroquois. In Iroquois society, as it existed when the white settlers first arrived, the men were hunters and warriors, while the women farmed, performed domestic chores, and made clothing from deerskins. This farming was, as elsewhere, without the benefit of draft animals, and therefore without the animal manure used to maintain fertility in other parts of the world. This meant that the Iroquois found it necessary for the Iroquois to move to new locations every few years, as the fertility declined on a given expanse of farmland. Dependence on deer skins for clothing likewise meant that a modest number of Iroquois required a vast amount of land in which to hunt the deer required to keep themselves clothed. The Mohawks, for example, with an estimated population of less than 8,000 people, controlled an area with more than 75,000 deer, of whom about a third could be culled annually without threatening the herds with extinction. As with the Iroquois Confederacy, so within its constituent nations, and even down to the individual longhouses, consensus was the mode of decision-making. As villages relocated, dissenters could split off to form their own communities, thus avoiding the internal strains of more hierarchical societies. Such social arrangements, as well as dependence on large deer populations and shifting agricultural sites, all required a very large expanse of land to support what would have been a relatively modest number of people by contemporary European standards. Such a way of life was not conducive to urban civilizations, such as those of the Aztecs and Incas, or of Europeans and Asians. Although consensus, and often unanimity, were required for group decisions among the Iroquois, with chiefs having only such authority as was accorded them by their people for the purpose at hand, relations among the nations of the Confederation were by no means always equal, and relations between the Confederacy and other Indians were far from harmonious. Although equals were called brothers among the Iroquois, the Mohawks, Senecas, and Onondagas were considered elder brothers to the Oneidas, Cayugas, and Tuscaroras. Warfare between the Iroquois and their enemies involved not only the carnage of battle, but also sadistic tortures of captives, which might be prolonged for hours or even days, until death finally ensued. Sometimes ritualized cannibalism was also practiced. However, not all captives were tortured or eaten by any means. It was the men of the opposing tribe who might suffer this fate, as well as enslavement, but women and children were simply taken prisoner and usually absorbed into the conquering tribe. So were many men, depending on the needs for population replacement, especially after large losses due to warfare or to epidemics. However, prisoners brought back to the visitor's village could expect to be forced to run a gauntlet, in which even the women and children of the victorious tribe would beat or stab them. Women who had suffered losses of family members could revenge themselves by torturing captives, or might choose to adopt them instead as replacements. Later, European missionaries could likewise suffer death, mutilation, or enslavement, or might succeed in winning converts to Christianity. Trade with the European settlers began to change the Iroquois way of life in various ways from the early colonial era onward. Cloth quickly became a substitute or supplement to deerskin clothing, so that even the earliest drawings of Iroquois people seldom showed them in their authentic traditional dress as it existed before contact with the European settlers and their cloth. Copper kettles from Europe were also preferred to the indigenous earthenware pots, and iron and steel cooking utensils, knives, and arrowheads were likewise preferred to their own indigenous counterparts. Above all, firearms crucially changed the balance of power between the Iroquois and other Indian nations without such ready access to the new weapons. Moreover, as the use of firearms spread, the Iroquois abandoned their wooden and leather body armor, which had been useful against arrows but not against bullets, and now opted for the greater mobility permitted by no longer carrying this additional weight. Even the wampum, so much identified with North American Indians, began to be made with European tools and changed in character as a result. European arms and European alliances became crucial to the outcomes of wars among Indians, so that the Iroquois, among others, became, increasingly over time, satellites or clients of the white settlers, without the formality of conquest in most cases. At the same time, the rivalries among European powers made the Iroquois valuable allies in the power politics and repeated outbreaks of warfare among the French, English, and Dutch. Over time, the Iroquois' domain expanded and contracted with the changing fortunes of war and power politics among Indians. Alliances shifted over the years, both among Indians and between particular Indians and particular groups of European settlers. It was considered a fundamental principle of Iroquois diplomacy to regard no treaty as settling anything once and for all. Later, they would discover that many white authorities took the same view, to the detriment of the Iroquois. As firearms began to spread among rival Indian peoples, the Mohawks lost their initial military advantages around the middle of the 17th century. The Mohicans and the Ottawas defeated them in 1662, and they failed to defeat the Susquehannock or the Delaware Indians the following year. Their raids against the Algonquins in Massachusetts provoked retaliatory raids against Mohawk settlements that continued for a decade. The ascendancy of the British in North America, as they drove out the Dutch and battled the French, represented for the Iroquois in general and the Mohawks in particular both the loss of their Dutch allies and the strengthening of their Indian enemies by the British. However, the British and the Iroquois eventually concluded an historic alliance called the Covenant Chain, which provided a framework for peaceful settlement of their differences and established, as the British saw it, a claim to vast expanses of land from New England to the Carolinas and westward to the Great Lakes, since the various Iroquois nations had raided and made claims, of varying degrees of authenticity, to sovereignty over this region, while the British saw the alliance as establishing British sovereignty over the Iroquois. The Cherokees. Like many other North American Indians, the Cherokee tribe or nation was not a unified political unit under one authority, but rather a collection of autonomous local communities connected by ties of culture, kinship, and alliances. Cherokee settlements were concentrated along the geographic dividing line of the Appalachian Mountain Range, from which waters flowed eastward toward the Atlantic and westward toward the Mississippi. As with other North American Indians, the area used by the Cherokees as a hunting range vastly exceeded the area in which they were permanently settled. As of the time of initial contact with the Europeans, the Cherokees were settled mostly in what is today western North Carolina and eastern Tennessee, while also occupying part of the northern fringe of what is today Georgia and the northwestern fringe of what is today South Carolina. This irregularly shaped settlement region extended no more than 200 miles in any given direction. However, the lands over which Cherokee hunters roamed, and which they claimed as their own, extended across most of today's Tennessee and Kentucky, major parts of the Carolinas, as well as large areas in Georgia, Alabama, Virginia, and West Virginia. Initially, one of the largest tribes east of the Mississippi, the Cherokees numbered about 20,000 people in 1690. But their population declined to only about half that size less than 50 years later, as warfare and European diseases took their toll among them. In short, before the arrival of the Europeans, a population measured in tens of thousands occupied an area which today supports a population measured in tens of millions. Even in the 17th century, far more people lived on similar-sized areas in Europe or Asia. The Cherokees held this territory on the same basis as other nations held land around the world, military force. Archaeological evidence shows that other Indians had once occupied land that the Cherokees controlled when the Europeans arrived. The Cherokees had defeated in battle the Shawnee, the Creeks, the Catawba, and the Tuscarora, with their rival claims from various points of the compass. The limits of the Cherokee domain were likewise circumscribed by military force, that of the Iroquois to the north and the Chickasaw to the west. Over time, however, the new military powers from Europe would acquire the land from all of these Indians, though through varying tactics. Just when the first contact was made between Cherokees and Europeans remains a matter of conjecture, as does the question as to whether these Europeans were Spaniards moving up from Florida or the British or French moving down from their various trade and settlement areas. However, by the late 17th century, contact had been made between whites and Cherokees, and by the first quarter of the 18th century, trading relations had been established between the two. By 1716, the government of South Carolina took control of this trade. The nature and extent of the trade was new, not only because of the people and the goods involved, but also because such extensive trade had not been feasible before among the Cherokees themselves, before the introduction of the horse from Europe, especially among those living in rugged, mountainous areas. As elsewhere in North America, large-scale trade between the Indians and the whites set in motion massive and rapid cultural, political, and demographic changes among the Cherokees. The demand for animal skins by the Europeans led to the slaughter of an estimated 250,000 deer over a 20-year period, with an estimated 50 tons of animal skins being delivered by the Cherokees in a single year. Hunting and trading on this scale entailed a neglect of other traditional activities and industries by the Indian men, and reflected also a growing Cherokee demand for European cloth, clothing, metal tools and implements, as well as guns and decorative goods. Many of these things replaced the products of various traditional crafts among the Indians. Guns, for example, replaced bows and arrows, and metal replaced stone in knives and tomahawks. The plow and the hand loom replaced traditional farming and clothes-making methods. Livestock began to be kept by Indians in imitation of the whites, and fruits and vegetables from Europe, as well as watermelons from Africa and potatoes from other parts of the country, began to be grown by the Cherokees. The most radical change, however, were the devastating European diseases that struck the Cherokee, as they did other Indians throughout the Western Hemisphere. The consequences of these diseases were cultural as well as biological, undermining faith in Cherokee medicine men whose traditional methods of treating diseases had no effect, or even a negative effect, in trying to cope with these strange new maladies. Moreover, as the Cherokees lost hunting grounds and came to depend on European clothing and European guns for hunting, a Cherokee chief stated plainly in 1745 that they were no longer capable of living independently of the English. As elsewhere in North America, growing white populations and declining Indian populations created economic conditions in which land was often traded for European goods. While the declining population of the Cherokees made some land sales an economically reasonable way of acquiring many of the European commodities that the Indians wanted, the magnitude of the land losses went far beyond what the Indians voluntarily offered on the market and included vast areas extorted under pressure, threats, and chicanery. The magnitude of these land losses also left the Cherokees with insufficient land to support themselves in their previous way of life, in which men's role as hunters were a major source of tribal livelihood, supplemented by women's role as farmers and homemakers. Now, agriculture became the primary way of feeding themselves, with hunting much reduced, both because of the smaller hunting grounds now available and because of the growing scarcity of game after years of increased hunting to gain animal skins and furs to trade with the white settlers. The consequences were cultural as well as economic. Many Cherokee men disdained farming as women's work, and both males and females were unfamiliar with the European style of intensive farming with horse-drawn plows and other agricultural tools and techniques. Federal agents sent to live among the Indians tried to provide these implements and teach these techniques, but a whole way of farming that took centuries to develop in Europe could hardly be superimposed on Indian culture very quickly, even if there had been ample farm implements and many experienced farmers working as federal agents, neither of which was the case. Even those Cherokee leaders who were anxious to acquire the means of emulating the white man's way of life, and these were by no means the norm, were reduced to constant entreaties to the federal agents to get them more plows, more horses, and more of all the other things that were necessary. The Cherokees became dependent in other ways. The money paid for the sale of their land to the federal government was partly received in a lump sum and partly in the form of annuities. In both cases, the Cherokees had to use this money not only for the increasingly difficult task of supporting their daily livelihood, but also to buy implements needed for domestic or agricultural tasks, and to repay credit advanced by both federal agents and white traders to provide food and other purchases. In short, the Cherokees were drawn into a money economy with which they had had little prior experience. At crucial times during negotiations with the federal government, federal officials could threaten the Cherokees with a suspension or cutoff of the flows of this money if the Indians did not accede to demands for more land or for rights of way for whites to build roads through existing Indian lands. Perhaps the most galling dependency of all was the Cherokee dependency on law enforcement by whites at various levels of government. While the Cherokee leaders' agreements were made first with the British in colonial times and then later with the federal government of the United States, neither of these distant governments could be depended upon to exert much control over local white frontiersmen. Indeed, even local governments and local law enforcement officials on the scene had considerable trouble controlling the independent frontiersmen, even when there was the political will to do so, which was often lacking as well when it came to protecting Indians. The net result was that it was difficult to get white squatters removed from Cherokee land, and virtually impossible to get whites convicted for crimes, including murder, against Cherokees. On the other hand, Cherokees who killed whites were hanged. Even on those occasions when the U.S. Army could be gotten to force white squatters off Cherokee land, the Cherokees remained a dependent people, unable to fight their own battles, as in times past. Not surprisingly, many Cherokees did not wish to take on the white man's ways or to live in a state of dependency on white government and white justice, while other Cherokees saw cultural assimilation as the best option available under the circumstances. The internal divisions thus generated among the Cherokees became sharp, bitter, and lasting, all weakening their ability to present a united front to either local whites or to the federal government. Federal agents learned how to play on these internal divisions to advance the government's agenda as well as their own. That agenda centered on culturally assimilating the Cherokees and acquiring more of their land. After a history as a proud, warlike people, to be reduced themselves to either childlike dependency on the federal government or to helplessness in the face of discrimination, insults, and even crimes by white settlers was too much to be accepted by many of the Cherokees. Some sought revenge in raids on white settlements, some sought economic benefits through horse thefts, and others escaped through liquor. In colonial times, the Cherokees had been able to take advantage of rivalries among the various European powers contending for land and strategic advantages in North America, especially the British, the French, and the Spanish. However, this drew the Cherokees into international conflicts, including warfare. Initially allied with the British during their wars with the French, some Cherokees switched sides when British settlers in their region used the unsettled conditions of war as an occasion to invade Cherokee lands. Defeat in battle forced the Cherokees to settle on British terms. More importantly, over time, the defeat of the French by the British and then the defeat of the British by the American colonists left the Cherokees facing a far larger and more united nation alone. This situation forced internal political changes among the Cherokees themselves, both because they needed to present a more unified front and because white officials wanted to deal with leaders capable of making agreements binding on the Cherokees, or at least on a particular branch of the Cherokees. The net result was an increase in the power of chiefs, and especially of chiefs sympathetic to, or compliant with, the views of whites. While there were leaders, such as George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, who took a paternalistically benevolent view of the Indians, their influence on local events and practices were limited, partly by distance and partly by the nature of the federal constitution. The frontiersmen with whom the Indians were in immediate contact, many of them Scotch-Irish, with a history of disregard of authority on both sides of the Atlantic, as well as in Australia, were able to fight the Indians on their own, without either help or sanction from local or national governments. It was this fundamental imbalance in power that was at the heart of the Indians' troubles, however complicated the situation was by other racial, political, and other considerations. Corrupt white politicians, anxious for Indian lands, and corrupt Indian chiefs, ready to enrich themselves by selling out their own people's interests, were major factors in the transfer of Indian lands at prices far below the market level. Christian missionaries with higher motives nevertheless inadvertently contributed to internal divisiveness within the Cherokee communities, making for internal strife and disunity between assimilated and traditional Indians in the face of constant pressures toward dispossession of the land and dissolution of the Cherokee culture and community. Much of that pressure came from the soaring growth of the American population, which was about 5 million at the beginning of the 19th century and more than quadrupled to 23 million by mid-century. Like many other transplanted populations, the descendants of the white settlers of the eastern seaboard conceived of themselves as being just as native-born as the Indians, and just as entitled to the use of the land and resources of the country. Indeed, they conceived of themselves as better able to make these lands and resources more productive through better technology, better farming techniques, and greater willingness to work. Indians were seen as a nuisance and an obstacle to progress. At more mundane levels, armed frontiersmen saw Indian hunting grounds as empty land where they could build farms. Land speculators saw a golden opportunity to make personal fortunes by taking over Indian lands on a grander scale, while corrupt politicians saw opportunities for both financial gains and the advancement of their political careers by catering to the desires of their constituents. Given these attitudes and ambitions on the one hand, and the great imbalance of power on the other, there were growing and ultimately irresistible pressures to force the Indians further west, so that whites could take control of the territory east of the Mississippi River. Two very different major developments of the 1820s had lasting effects on the Cherokees. First, a Cherokee silversmith and blacksmith named Sequoia decided to create for his people a system of writing for their language, just as whites had written versions of their languages. In addition to the practical advantages of now having a written language, the Cherokees were said to develop a new sense of pride, a pride manifestly tangible in an 1827 rebellion. On the other hand, this creation of a written Cherokee language and the accompanying sense of cultural parity with whites also helped alienate the less assimilated Cherokees from those more assimilated to European culture, thereby creating yet another source of disunity within the tribe. The other historic event of the 1820s was the election of Andrew Jackson as President of the United States. Jackson, himself a frontiersman and the leader of a populist cause, did not take the patrician paternalist view of Indians held by George Washington and Thomas Jefferson before him, but instead began a massive removal program to force the Indians, even the acculturated civilized tribes, to move west of the Mississippi so that white settlers could expand into the vacated territory. Jackson considered it a farce that the federal government dealt with Indian tribes as if they were sovereign nations, dismissed as visionary the recognition of Indian claims to tracts of land on which they have neither dwelt nor made improvements, merely because they have seen them from the mountains or passed them in the chase. Cherokees were just one of the tribes forced from their ancestral lands to make way for white settlers under the new removal laws and policies. A variety of methods were used to get Indians off the land, leaving a variety of enduring financial obligations and legal entanglements between the federal government and the various Indian tribes. The involuntary removal of masses of human beings in the era before the transportation revolution was a logistical and human nightmare. The federal government had to rely on private individuals to transport tens of thousands of Indians and to feed them en route. While these contractors often profited handsomely from this operation, it was a very different story for the Indians themselves. A contemporary newspaper account described rotten, old, and unseaworthy boats used to transport Indians who were crammed aboard with not the slightest regard for their safety, comfort, or even decency. One such steamboat sank with more than 300 Creek Indians on board. A contemporary account by a missionary described another scene of the resettlement. A Marine officer led a caravan of 2,000 Creek Indians westward into sleet storms, with the Indians wearing only cotton garments and suffering 29 deaths on the way. Altogether, about half the Creek Nation perished either en route to their new western homes or in the early years of struggling to survive there. Farther north, the Winnebago tribe was forced to relocate repeatedly over a period of 30 years, also suffering mortality rates estimated at 50%. It was, however, the massive sufferings of the Cherokees during their removal to the west which gave rise to the historic phrase, the Trail of Tears, which could apply as well to other Indians. An estimated 15,000 people, three-quarters of the Cherokee tribe, were forcibly moved west. Squads of soldiers surrounded individual Cherokee farms and marched the family members from their homes to stockades where larger groups were assembled for the trip beyond the Mississippi. A contemporary missionary described the scene. The poor captive, in a state of distressing agitation, his weeping wife almost frantic with terror, surrounded by a group of crying, terrified children, without a friend to speak a comforting word. Under such conditions, the Indians could neither sell their belongings nor make preparations for the long journey ahead of them. Local whites often looted or burned the homes left behind. Between 1795 and 1838 alone, more than 419 million acres of Indian land was acquired by the federal government, either for cash or annuities, or in exchange of other lands, usually frontier land farther west, though some Indian reservations were also created east of the Mississippi. In just one decade, from 1828 to 1838, more than 80,000 Indians were moved west of the Mississippi. Here they often encountered the armed resistance of the Indians of that region, as whites would later in the century. As early as 1816, there were clashes between the tribes migrating from the east and those already living in the regions where they were being resettled. Even after the migrating Indians established settlements, these were often raided by the indigenous Indians, as would happen to whites later on. Although federal troops were available to enforce the resettlement treaties, there were not enough of them to protect the migrating Indians, who had to defend themselves. Although no longer as used to the warrior's way of life as the Plains Indians, the Eastern Indians were, however, better armed. In one encounter in 1853, for example, about 100 Sac and Fox Indians held off several hundred Plains Indians. Over time, the Cherokees and the other transplanted members of the five civilized tribes fared better economically on the Western Plains than did the Plains Indians themselves. In the late 20th century, the Cherokees were the largest of the Indian tribes, 369,035 people, according to the 1990 census, or more than 15 times their number in the 17th century. Most lived in the South, their historic homeland. The median family income of Cherokees was $24,907, or about 69% of the median family income of whites. The Plains Indians. As the frontier pushed farther west with the rapidly growing population of the United States in the 19th century, the white pioneers moving westward encountered not only the Indians displaced earlier from the eastern regions of the country, but also the indigenous Plains Indians, the Apaches, Comanches, Navajo, Cheyenne, and other Indians made famous in Western movies and Wild West literature. Many of these Indians were hunters and warriors who had retained a greater political and cultural independence of the European settlers, and some in the Southwest had rebelled against Spanish rule and continued to raid Mexican settlements. Perhaps most important of all, the Plains Indians had been introduced to the horse during the era when what is today the American Southwest was part of Mexico, and the horse brought a revolutionary transformation of life on the plains. Tribes once sedentary and agricultural became nomadic in their pursuit of the buffalo, whose hides found a ready market in the white economy and whose meat supplied the Indians with food. The horse changed hunting techniques from those of tightly controlled large hunting parties on foot to much wider ranging and smaller groups or even individuals who could successfully attack buffalo on horseback over much wider distances. A skilled hunter could kill enough buffalo in a matter of minutes to supply his family for months. The horse also made possible the transport of much heavier loads than had been possible by human porters or by dog-drawn sleds. Accordingly, Indian tents grew larger, now that more building material and household contents could be transported. These wider-ranging forays also brought tribesmen into other tribes' hunting grounds, providing more occasions for warfare. While the horse was the most important of the animals introduced from Europe into the Western Hemisphere, cattle and sheep also became part of the economy and the culture of the Plains Indians. 2 centuries before white Americans moved west in massive numbers after the Civil War, cattle and sheep had become familiar to the Indians in the West, largely because the Spaniards had brought these animals to New Spain, which encompassed what is today California and the American Southwest. Thus, cattle were present in this region as early as the 17th century, even though the golden age of American cattle herding was in the last half of the 19th century. The horse, an essential complement for cattle herding, was likewise introduced to the Plains Indians in the 17th century. The horse diffused northward and eastward from the Spanish settlements, the northern Plains Indians getting them much later, perhaps as late as the 18th century. Farther south, however, Spanish records show raiding Apaches carrying off hundreds of horses in 1659. Half a century later, Comanche and Ute Indians raided Apache horses. While Indians could obtain horses through trade with the Spaniards, the latter would not trade guns to the Indians. Meanwhile, the English and the French to the east of the Plains Indians would trade guns. With guns diffusing southward and westward from the British and French colonial settlements in Canada and in the 13 American colonies, the horse frontier and the gun frontier eventually met in the 18th century on the Great Plains, and a new way of life began for the Indians there. The Lewis and Clark expedition was able to buy horses from Indians in 1805, and they commented on the herds of these animals that the Indians possessed at that time. By the time whites began moving into the plains in large numbers in the 19th century, the Indians there had long been mounted warriors with firearms. As of 1860, the Blackfoot Indians had as many horses as people. The geographic setting of the Western Plains was quite different from that of the Eastern United States. There were far fewer navigable rivers in the West, and of course there was no access to the ocean from the plains, so that waterborne transportation played a much smaller economic and military role in this region than in the East. Like other climates in the interior of continents, that on the Western Plains was more bitterly cold in the winter and more witheringly hot in the summer than climates in coastal areas, where a large adjacent body of water moderated temperatures. While there was fertile land in some places, there were also large regions of desert, semi-desert, and otherwise barren land in the West. Under these conditions, the Western Indian population was more thinly spread over vast areas, which might seem to make them more vulnerable to invasion. On the other hand, the distances involved and the scarcity of navigable waterways meant that American military forces in the region often had to be supplied by difficult and expensive overland routes, and in many places could be deployed only by foot or on horseback before the era of railroad building in the mid-19th century. Here again, however, European diseases preceded the mass movements of whites themselves into the plains. In the quarter century preceding the Civil War, epidemics of smallpox and cholera devastated Indians in the West. Only about half of the Blackfoot Indians survived the smallpox epidemic, and only 100 out of 1,600 Mandans lived through it. Half the Comanches died of cholera, and other tribes were similarly afflicted. While the Plains Indians were weakened in numbers, there were growing numbers of Americans, and the United States government was unchallenged by any other world power in its claim to all the land from the Atlantic to the Pacific between Mexico and Canada. Unlike the Indians in colonial times, the Plains Indians could expect no help from alliances with contending European imperial powers, nor did Americans any longer need the Indians as allies against such powers. The advancing technology of weaponry and transport also shifted the balance of power more toward the Americans militarily. Trains, for example, could carry troops as far in a day as they could march in a month. Moreover, after the Civil War, the American Army had many battle-experienced commanders, of whom Sherman and Custer were the best known, to lead troops in the West. While the odds against the Plains Indians in their resistance to the westward push of whites into their territories were less favorable than in the past, the alternatives were more desperate, for now there was no other land farther west that could be offered to them on which to resettle. They had to fight or submit where they were. Thus the stage was set for the battles that would rage for decades on the Western Plains until the last battle at Wounded Knee in 1890 marked the end of Indian armed resistance. It was from this era that much of the image of the American Indian and of the American pioneers emerged. The Indian chiefs whose names became famous, Geronimo, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, were leaders of the fierce, bloody, bitter, but ultimately unavailing resistance. The ferocity and mercilessness of the struggle on both sides generated burning hatreds and hideous acts of revenge and counter-revenge that poisoned relations between whites and Indians for generations. After years of smoldering resentments among Indians in Minnesota over the way they were being cheated and mistreated by federal officials, in 1862, four young Sioux murdered five white settlers on a dare, initiating an outpouring of Indian violence that led to wide-ranging attacks on white farm settlements in which the men were killed and the women and children taken captive, while bands of Indians spread across the countryside, pillaging, raping, and burning. About 400 whites were killed in a day. American military forces struck back, capturing 2,000 Sioux, of whom about 300 were sentenced to hang on the basis of questionable evidence about their individual guilt. After reviewing the trial record, President Lincoln reduced the number to be hanged to 38 over vehement protests from local whites. The Sioux as a whole, however, lost their reservation as a result of these outbreaks and were moved farther west, as were the Winnebagoes, for the local pressure to be rid of all Indians was politically irresistible. In the Southwest, Indian and Hispanic inhabitants of New Mexico had a long history of raids and counter-raids against one another, as well as peaceful trade in between. With the coming of the Civil War and a movement of federal troops out of the region to fight against the Confederates in the East, the Navajos stepped up their raids. However, as the rapidly growing Union Army acquired more troops, new reinforcements arrived in the region and struck back at the Navajos, not only killing many of them, but also destroying their crops and livestock in order to starve them into surrender. Meanwhile, other Indian tribes, such as the Pueblos and Hopis, seized the opportunity to plunder the Navajos, as did local whites. After the Navajos were forced to surrender, they were then moved by the thousands to a new region where they had inadequate land, where their flocks were raided by the Comanches and Kiowas, and where they were barely able to survive on rations issued by the federal government. In Colorado, a massive military response to Cheyenne raids on whites led to a massacre of 200 Indians, including women, children, and even infants, all of whom were scalped and their bodies mutilated. One sign of the animosity existing between the whites and Indians at this point was that these Cheyenne scalps were then exhibited on stage in a Denver theater at intermission to the applause of the audience. Meanwhile, as the survivors of the massacres reached Indian settlements, reactions among the Cheyenne, Sioux, and Arapaho led to Indian attacks on white settlements for months thereafter, the Indians burning ranches, plundering wagon trains, ripping up miles of telegraph wire, scattering cattle herds, and cutting off Denver from the east. Then the Indians melted away, and even massive military expeditions failed to find them in the vast, rugged, and empty lands of the region. While American military forces were able to offer more security to white settlements and travel routes, their long supply lines were not only logistical handicaps, but also betrayed their visible presence to Indians, who could then escape. Not all the Plains Indians fought, and not all the land was conquered. The federal government continued to purchase land at prices below the market level, and some Indians negotiated whatever terms they could, living thereafter on reservations with varying degrees of security from white encroachment. Just as the Eastern Indians had hunted beavers and deer to virtual extinction, so the Plains Indians hunted the buffalo to virtual extinction, using the horse and the rifle. In both cases, this left the Indians more dependent on the surrounding white society and economy in general, and on the federal government in particular. Government policy. The creation of the Bureau of Indian Affairs in 1834 led to a long-term commitment to social engineering experiments with the Indians, based on radically different assumptions, methods, and goals at different periods of history, but creating dependency throughout. After the Civil War, for example, the federal government found itself feeding 100,000 Indians. The net result was that large numbers of formerly energetic and aggressive warriors became enervated and dispirited recipients of the dole. While national policies toward the Indians were formulated in Washington, often under the influence of idealistic but uninformed humanitarian movements in the East, these policies were carried out on the reservations by federal agents who were often neither idealistic nor humanitarian, but were instead political appointees, less known for their ability than for their connections, and often less interested in the well-being of the Indians than in their own opportunities for lucrative corruption. Indeed, the prospect of living on a bleak Indian reservation was not one likely to attract able and honest men with alternatives elsewhere, though the job of federal agent there could be very attractive to men who were the opposite of able and honest. The hostility of the white population in the West toward the Indian, and the impatience of these local whites to acquire more of the vast amounts of land required for the Plains Indians' way of life, were crucial ingredients in the mixture of motives and pressures which produced the turbulent era of Indian-white armed conflict from the mid-19th century to the last decade of that century. In Alaska, where there were vast expanses of unused land readily available for white settlers without dispossessing the native Eskimos, there was no organized warfare on either side, no reservations set aside for the indigenous people, and no campaigns for treaties to transfer title to the land on which the Eskimos lived, at the same time when all these things were going on in the American West under the same national government. In Canada, the peaceful settlement of whites on the land was for a long time more like what happened in Alaska than like what happened in the rest of the United States. But only until the growing number of whites attracted to the Canadian frontier found the available land no longer sufficient for their development, and when the Indians began to experience diminished opportunities for hunting game. From that point on, the history of white-Indian relations in Canada began to follow a pattern similar to that in the United States, including an armed uprising in 1885, treaties to transfer Indian lands to whites, and the creation of Indian reservations to remove the indigenous peoples as a distraction or an obstacle to the development of the country. In the United States, Easterners appalled by stories of the cheating, oppression, and violence against Indians in the West, and convinced that Indians could be educated and taught the skills needed to adjust to the kind of life lived in American society, launched programs to train them to do just that, both through government and through private humanitarian undertakings. These schemes of social engineering included getting Indians to substitute farming for the hunting that was rapidly depleting the buffalo herds and other game, which in turn would mean that the Indian population could feed itself by agricultural produce on much less land than that required for hunting, thereby allowing surplus Indian land to be sold to whites and for the West to be developed economically. Only on the transfer of Indian land was there unanimity between whites in the East and the West, as well as among the humanitarians, the speculators, and the politicians. Not surprisingly, this was the only part of the grand schemes for the Indians' future that was carried out successfully. Forcibly herding Indians onto reservations proved to be a difficult and protracted process, and keeping them there was often even more difficult, given the limitations of the land and the unfamiliarity of the whole way of life that others had designed for the Indians. This way of life was in fundamental conflict with the Indians' habits and their cultural values. Farming, for example, was regarded by many of the Plains Indian men as demeaning, while hunting, raiding, and fighting were time-honored roles. Moreover, so long as buffalo herds remained a valuable economic asset and the federal government supplied rations and annuities, incentives to change were lessened. The problem was not one of the whole white race against the whole indigenous race, for neither side was monolithic. Moreover, blacks were a significant presence in the American West, particularly as soldiers after the Civil War, as they had been a significant presence as slaves of both Indians and whites in the antebellum South. Despite the bitter hostility between whites and Indians on the American frontier, both during the era when the frontier was east of the Mississippi and later when it was out on the Western Plains, the humanitarian movements of Eastern whites, which had great effect on the general direction of both governmental and private efforts to aid and assimilate the Indians, was equally real, even if often unrealistic in its goals and methods. The first American program for the preferential hiring of minorities began in the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the early 19th century, where Indians were to be preferred as employees, a preference reaffirmed over the years in successive waves of legislation until the federal government became the principal employer of educated Indians. These were enduring patterns. As of 1940, 60% of the 5,000 employees of the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs were Indians, and the 1980 census revealed that a higher percentage of Indians than of any other American ethnic group worked for the federal government. Summary and implications. Although the story of the conquests by European invaders in the Western Hemisphere was quite different in different regions of the hemisphere, certainly in timing and detail, there were fundamental similarities in the patterns that emerged over the centuries. European diseases and European technology were crucial elements in these conquests, and the subsequent disintegration of the Indians' own cultures were crucial to the fate of the indigenous peoples. Loss of the land and other resources that made their previous way of life possible was one reason for the loss of much of the indigenous culture over time. The clear superiority of European military weapons and of European products coveted by the Indians in preference to their own likewise undermined Indian confidence in their own traditions. Some practical aspects of the North American Indian culture in particular were lost because these Indians were drawn into the international trading networks of the Europeans and often as a result abandoned some of their indigenous products and skills in favor of supplying their needs from trade with the settlers. Because what the North American Indians had to offer were largely the hides and skins of animals that were hunted to virtual extinction, these Indians later found themselves without either the foreign sources of livelihood through trade or the skills and natural resources on which they or their ancestors had relied. From the standpoint of the white settlers in North America, on the other hand, the Indians were at first often indispensable, but in later generations became expendable, and finally were regarded as simply an obstacle to expansion across the continent, after the transplanted European society became self-sufficient and self-confident in the New World. The situation among the indigenous peoples of South America and Central America was not the same as that among the North American Indians. Demographically, in various regions of Latin America, the Indians constituted the bulk of the population, centuries after the Europeans landed. In Bolivia, for example, in the middle of the 20th century, 60% of the country's population consisted of Indians speaking an indigenous language. It was another quarter of a century before a majority of Bolivians spoke Spanish. Mexico's population has long been predominantly mestizo, between 75 and 90%, with some of the remainder being full-blooded Indians. Venezuela, Chile, and Paraguay have likewise had predominantly mestizo populations. Indians and mestizos were each about 40% of the population of Ecuador during the 1980s, with the remainder being white or black. In Colombia, an estimated 50% of the population was mestizo, 25% white, and the remainder black, Indian, or some racially mixed combinations of these. In Peru, about two-fifths of the population spoke native languages as late as 1960, though half of these people also spoke Spanish. In short, while what had been British North America became demographically and culturally a transplanted European society, that was by no means equally true throughout the remainder of the hemisphere, nor were the indigenous peoples of the hemisphere absorbed into this transplanted European culture to the same degree. These differences between the Indians of Latin America and those of British North America reflected differences between the settlement patterns of the whites in the two regions. The mass transfer of men, women, and children to British North America more thoroughly Europeanized the United States and Canada culturally, swamping the indigenous peoples, both demographically and culturally. While the Indians of Latin America were conquered militarily much earlier, more of them remained culturally indigenous to a greater extent, even when they were forced to pay tribute or otherwise submit to subjugation by a thin layer of Spanish or Portuguese overlords. Throughout the Americas, a significant portion of the indigenous population became genetically part Caucasian, and that portion tended also to be more culturally Europeanized as well. Sometimes this was because of intermarriages, but even when racial mixtures were not formalized by marriage, obviously those Indian populations in closer proximity to white populations were more likely to become both culturally and genetically amalgamated with the Europeans. As in the case of people of African ancestry in the Western Hemisphere, those Indians more culturally and genetically similar to Europeans had more opportunities to acquire European skills, beginning with language and knowledge of European ways, all of which helped them not only in dealing with the white settlers, but also in acquiring leadership roles and other privileges within Indian societies. Relations between the conquered and the conquerors. The often tragic history of Western Hemisphere Indians parallels the history of conquered peoples around the world, not only in terms of the suffering endured, but also in terms of the betrayals of agreements and the contempt often shown to the subjugated peoples. While the prevalence of similar patterns in other regions of the world and other periods of history does not lessen the human tragedy or the moral enormity, it does have implications as far as causation is concerned. The reasons for this history cannot be assumed to be peculiar to either or both of the races involved, or to their particular relationships to one another or their perceptions of one another, for much the same results have been found among conquerors and conquered on every continent and in every era of history. While violations of treaties, for example, have been common in the history of European expansion into the lands of the indigenous populations of the Western Hemisphere, treaties in other parts of the world have likewise usually remained in force only so long as the set of power relationships which led to those treaties in the first place. Among the Indians themselves, treaties were by no means regarded as permanently settling the issues covered, and Indian nations betrayed both whites and one another, just as Europeans broke treaties among themselves and with others. Treaties between France and Germany, for example, have transferred Alsace-Lorraine back and forth according to who won the most recent war. In the Western Hemisphere, however, the tide of power ran consistently against the indigenous peoples, making treaty revisions and violations consistently against the interests of the Indians. Drastic reductions of the Indian population, by both diseases and warfare, were exacerbated in their effects on the power balance by a constantly increasing European population, growing by both immigration and by natural increase, and seeking correspondingly more and more land on which to settle. In addition, the march of technology in Europe brought dramatic improvements in the kinds of weapons used by the white population in the Americas. Slow-firing muskets and cannons were succeeded by faster-firing weapons, made more accurate by rifling in their barrels. In the Western Hemisphere, as in Europe, Asia, and Africa, this turned the tide decisively against those who fought with bows and arrows. The Indians themselves began to master firearms, as they mastered the use of horses, which had never been seen in the Western Hemisphere before Columbus. In both cases, however, Indians were using European military patterns against people who originated such patterns and who had greater access to the latest developments, as well as controlling the supply and having the skills necessary to repair the Indians' firearms and their own. In short, despite hard-won victories here and there, the Indians were in general retreating repeatedly before the advance of the European invaders. The treaties made under these circumstances were little more than lengthy truces, lasting only until the balance of power changed still more decisively in favor of the Europeans, and the latter's growing population again developed more demand for territory and resources held by the Indians. For some within the transplanted European communities of the Americas, a moral dimension did enter into these military power relationships, however. Within these societies, some religious leaders, especially, became defenders of the rights of Indians and regarded treaties as moral commitments to them, rather than simply transient artifacts of real politic. The failure of such people to prevail, or to achieve much more than peripheral concessions and a mitigation of the worst aspects of conquest, was in keeping with the fate of political agreements and proclamations around the world, whether such commitments were made to people of the same or a different race. What was unusual about the agreements between the European invaders and the indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere was not that they were violated or infringed, but that voices and forces within the victorious societies protested against these violations and infringements, as well as against the general treatment of the conquered peoples. In later generations and centuries, these voices would grow louder and more effective, eventually giving some of these ancient treaties more force than other treaties of the same vintage, or other laws within the general community that had been allowed to become dead letters with the passage of time. Similar moral concerns among descendants of the conquerors led, first, to 19th century attempts to artificially assimilate the indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere into the new prevailing culture from Europe, and then, a century later, to attempts to artificially preserve or resurrect the indigenous culture that was eroding on its own. In neither case was it considered sufficient to let the indigenous peoples decide for themselves, individually, how much of the old and how much of the new they wished to accept. Nowhere is it more necessary to make a sharp distinction between historic and contemporary effects than in assessing the impact of European society and culture on the indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere. For the era of the conquest and of the consolidation of European hegemony in the Americas, that impact was catastrophic, not simply because of a loss of territory and sovereignty on the part of the Indians, but also because of the widespread decimation, in some places virtual extinction, of the indigenous population by European diseases, and because the demoralizing destruction of existing cultures could not be followed in any timely way by their replacement by the cultures of Europe needed to cope with radically different conditions. Within many Indian communities, divisive new religious doctrines tore apart the social bonds embodied and affirmed in indigenous rituals and beliefs, while loss of control of the natural resources required by the traditional way of life often rendered traditional skills obsolete and the way of life based on them impossible. The wars, atrocities, and betrayals accompanying all this provided the dramatic events by which this era would be remembered, though such afflictions have been all too common across the planet, including in the Western Hemisphere before the first white man arrived. What was unique was the biological, social, and cultural havoc. The introduction of European liquor alone was to prove to be a curse enduring for centuries among the indigenous peoples, who proved to be exceptionally susceptible to alcoholism. All this is wholly different from saying that the present-day descendants of these indigenous peoples are worse off than if the Europeans had never come. Most of these descendants would not even exist without those invasions and conquests, for they are the descendants of the Europeans as well as descendants of the Indians, pure-blooded descendants of the latter being the exception rather than the rule in both North and South America. Nor can the benefits they receive from the advances of modern medicine and technology be taken for granted, for those benefits are still largely lacking over broad areas of the world outside the cultural orbit of Western civilization. Nowhere have the Indians shared as fully in these benefits as the general population of the Americas. How much of that is due to discriminatory treatment, and how much to the Indians not having yet acquired the full range of skills common in European offshoot societies, is an empirical question, whose answer may vary in different parts of the hemisphere. However, in the United States, differences between the earnings of Indian males and white males were, by the late 20th century, due largely to demographic, language, and educational differences. Overall, however, American Indians had by 1969 an income not very different from that of black Americans. As late as 1989, when per capita income for the United States as a whole was $14,420, the per capita income of Indians in the United States was $8,284. Median family income for American Indians was $21,619, compared to $20,209 for blacks and $35,975 for whites. The cultural consequences of the original settlement patterns of whites in colonial North America and their subsequent movement westward is reflected in the fact that few of the descendants of Eastern Indians still speak their native languages after such a long exposure to English, while many more Indians from the Western United States still do. Among the Cherokees, for example, fewer than 10,000 still spoke their native tongue in 1990, while more than 142,000 Navajos did, even though Cherokees were the most numerous tribe of American Indians, with 369,035 people, while the Navajos were second with 225,298. Some of the most basic facts about Western Hemisphere Indians remain obscure or elusive. Widely varying estimates of the population of the hemisphere in 1492 are one symptom of this. However, even in the late 20th century, the increase in the Indian population of the United States from approximately 764,000 in 1970 to approximately 1,937,000 in 1990 seems difficult to attribute to any plausible rate of fertility. Such a huge increase in just 20 years seems more probably a reflection of social incentives to identify oneself as Indian. Among these incentives were the growing impact of ethnic pride and cultural identity trends, as well as the growing availability of both government and private benefits earmarked for a variety of minority groups, including American Indians. Given that most people who identify themselves as American Indians are not full-blooded Indians, considerable flexibility in self-identification makes it difficult to separate biological increases in this population from changing self-designations in response to changing social incentives. Considering that the number of American Indians barely doubled between the census of 1890, when it was not quite a quarter of a million, to that of 1960, when it was just over half a million, a nearly quadrupling of its size to almost 2 million in the 30 years after 1960 seems more like a social phenomenon than a biological phenomenon. The sense of historic or inherited guilt has become a major political factor in attempts to redress the wrongs suffered by the indigenous population, particularly in North America. Special privileges and exemptions from the laws affecting other citizens have become common for Indians, both in Canada and in the United States. For example, in the late 20th century, special hunting and fishing rights for Indians existed in an area constituting one-fourth of the entire land area of Canada, and large economic transfers and special political rights have been conferred as well. However, Indian incomes averaged less than half that of Canadians in general. Most Indians in Canada did not complete high school, and the mortality rates of their infants and young children was 3 times the national average. In the United States as well, the indigenous people have had special rights and many government programs designed to help them, though it is not clear whether this has in fact made them better off than they would have been otherwise. As the 20th century neared its end, approximately half of the 2 million Indians in the United States still lived on reservations, often in a state of dependency. At a time when North Dakota as a whole had an unemployment rate just below 2%, the unemployment rate among Sioux Indians on the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota was 75%. The history of the Indians in the Western Hemisphere has unfortunately long been seen not as something important in and of itself, but as raw material for proving one thesis or another. At various times in centuries past, the conquest of the Americas was seen as a triumph and vindication of Christianity or of Western civilization. Even in places where the treatment of Indians was directly counter to Christian morality and barbarous by any standard. Critics of Western civilization, however, often depicted the Indian as a noble savage with whom degenerate civilized man could be contrasted, again, with little regard to facts to the contrary. In our own times, cultural relativism has rewritten history in yet another way, perhaps epitomized by the semantic contortions used in response to the simple traditional statement that Columbus discovered America. The concept of discovery has become taboo, unless it is a reciprocity of discovery, or the even more neutral word, contact between the two worlds. Yet, plainly, Columbus discovered America in a sense in which Indians did not discover Europe, and it was an enormous event in the history of the human race, for good or ill, or both. Quibbles about the fact that some other European explorers touched the hemisphere earlier, or that the Indians knew it was here all along, trivialized this turning point in the history of the world. Late 20th century attempts to see or depict the world from the viewpoint of the conquered Indians face the intractable fact that the Indians of the era of conquest left no written accounts because their languages had no written versions, except for the language of the Maya, whose written version was only belatedly begun to be deciphered by scholars. Moreover, even for literate peoples, the moral and intellectual framework within which they perceived events is by no means as apparent as the events themselves, though even the bare facts may be distorted by various biases and agendas. The most that we can hope for realistically is to see the Indians honestly from our own viewpoint today. A complement to a necessary separation of fact from fancy is a separation of causation from morality. Those things most striking and salient from a moral point of view need not have been the most influential from a causal point of view. Unleashing wars of conquest has obvious moral implications, not only to observers of that time or later, but to the conquerors themselves, who went to great trouble to attempt to justify themselves morally and religiously, often with much ingenious hypocrisy. However, the unwitting spread of diseases is morally neutral, though often far more devastating. As a noted historian has observed, not even the most brutally depraved of the conquistadors was able purposely to slaughter Indians on the scale that the gentle priest unwittingly accomplished by going from his sickbed ministrations to lay his hands in blessing on his Indian converts. Similarly, the morally revolting history of discrimination and expropriation against the indigenous populations of the Western Hemisphere have often too easily been accepted as causal explanations of their generally lower socioeconomic levels in the various societies of the Americas. Yet, from a causal perspective, there was never any reason to have expected them all to have acquired the levels of Western technological skills and organizational development which took centuries to evolve in Europe. Since Eastern Europeans generally continued to lag behind Western Europeans in these respects, more than 1,000 years after the Slavs first entered East Central Europe, there is little basis for attributing all economic lags of American Indians in European offshoot societies to the biases of the majority populations of those societies. How much is in fact due to discrimination and how much to cultural lags is an empirical question, not a foregone conclusion. In the United States, for example, by the 1980s, American Indian males earned incomes quite comparable to those of white males, when various language, demographic, and other factors were held constant, even though American Indian males as a whole were still earning markedly less than white males as a whole. The proportion of the Indian and mestizo populations in 20th century Latin America has ranged from negligible in Argentina to demographically dominant in Peru, where in 1990, Spanish-speaking mestizos were 37% of the population and Quechua-speaking Indians were 45%. Full-blooded Indians have tended to be the least favored, both by nature and man. Biological resistance to European diseases came first to those who were part European themselves, as well as being more likely to move in a social milieu where there were Europeans from whom they could acquire biological resistance and social acculturation to the transplanted European civilization of the Western Hemisphere. In addition, both whites and mestizos often disdained and discriminated against the full-blooded Indians. The highland peoples of Peru, for example, the descendants of the Incas, were at one time referred to by the mestizos as brutes and savages, and were forced to step aside, sit in the back of buses, and otherwise humble themselves before those considered their social betters. The thrust of Peruvian education was to get the less assimilated Indians to acquire the Spanish language in place of the native tongues, which 39% of the native peoples still spoke as late as 1960, as well as acquiring the modes of dress and general ways of life of the culturally westernized majority. Western Hemisphere Indians can no more be summarized than Europeans or Asians or Africans can be summarized. Their cultural levels have ranged from the sophistication of the Maya, the Aztecs, and the Incas centuries ago to the primitiveness of the Amazon Indians to this moment. What is clear is that their world was irretrievably shattered, biologically, militarily, socially, and politically, and that their fate would henceforth be determined by how well they evolved new ways of dealing with a radically different and ever-changing reality around them. The sense of historic or inherited guilt has become a major political factor in attempts to redress the wrongs suffered by the indigenous population, particularly in North America. Special privileges and exemptions from the laws affecting other citizens have become common for Indians, both in Canada and in the United States. For example, in the late 20th century, special hunting and fishing rights for Indians existed in an area constituting 1/4 of the entire land area of Canada, and large economic transfers and special political rights have been conferred as well. However, Indian incomes averaged less than half that of Canadians in general. Most Indians in Canada did not complete high school, and the mortality rates of their infants and young children was 3 times the national average. In the United States as well, the indigenous people have had special rights and many government programs designed to help them, though it is not clear whether this has in fact made them better off than they would have been otherwise. As the 20th century neared its end, approximately half of the 2 million Indians in the United States still lived on reservations, often in a state of dependency. At a time when North Dakota as a whole had an unemployment rate just below 2%, the unemployment rate among Sioux Indians on the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota was 75%. The history of the Indians in the Western Hemisphere has unfortunately long been seen not as something important in and of itself, but as raw material for proving one thesis or another. At various times in centuries past, the conquest of the Americas was seen as a triumph and vindication of Christianity or of Western civilization, even in places where the treatment of Indians was directly counter to Christian morality and barbarous by any standard. Critics of Western civilization, however, often depicted the Indian as a noble savage with whom degenerate civilized man could be contrasted, again, with little regard to facts to the contrary. In our own times, cultural relativism has rewritten history in yet another way, perhaps epitomized by the semantic contortions used in response to the simple traditional statement that Columbus discovered America. The concept of discovery has become taboo, unless it is a reciprocity of discovery, or the even more neutral word, contact, between the two worlds. Yet, plainly, Columbus discovered America in a sense in which Indians did not discover Europe, and it was an enormous event in the history of the human race, for good or ill, or both. Quibbles about the fact that some other European explorers touched the hemisphere earlier, or that the Indians knew it was here all along, trivialized this turning point in the history of the world. Late 20th century attempts to see or depict the world from the viewpoint of the conquered Indians face the intractable fact that the Indians of the era of conquest left no written accounts because their languages had no written versions, except for the language of the Maya, whose written version was only belatedly begun to be deciphered by scholars. Moreover, even for literate peoples, the moral and intellectual framework within which they perceived events is by no means as apparent as the events themselves, though even the bare facts may be distorted by various biases and agendas. The most that we can hope for realistically is to see the Indians honestly from our own viewpoint today. A complement to a necessary separation of fact from fancy is a separation of causation from morality. Those things most striking and salient from a moral point of view need not have been the most influential from a causal point of view. Unleashing wars of conquest has obvious moral implications, not only to observers of that time or later, but to the conquerors themselves, who went to great trouble to attempt to justify themselves morally and religiously, often with much ingenious hypocrisy. However, the unwitting spread of diseases is morally neutral, though often far more devastating. As a noted historian has observed, not even the most brutally depraved of the conquistadors was able purposely to slaughter Indians on the scale that the gentle priest unwittingly accomplished by going from his sickbed ministrations to lay his hands in blessing on his Indian converts. Similarly, the morally revolting history of discrimination and expropriation against the indigenous populations of the Western Hemisphere have often too easily been accepted as causal explanations of their generally lower socioeconomic levels in the various societies of the Americas. Yet, from a causal perspective, there was never any reason to have expected them all to have acquired the levels of Western technological skills and organizational development which took centuries to evolve in Europe, since Eastern Europeans generally continued to lag behind Western Europeans in these respects. More than 1,000 years after the Slavs first entered East Central Europe, there is little basis for attributing all economic lags of American Indians in European offshoot societies to the biases of the majority populations of those societies. How much is in fact due to discrimination and how much to cultural lags is an empirical question, not a foregone conclusion. In the United States, for example, by the 1980s, American Indian males earned incomes quite comparable to those of white males, when various language, demographic, and other factors were held constant, even though American Indian males as a whole were still earning markedly less than white males as a whole. The proportion of the Indian and mestizo populations in 20th century Latin America has ranged from negligible in Argentina to demographically dominant in Peru, where in 1990, Spanish-speaking mestizos were 37% of the population and Quechua-speaking Indians were 45%. Full-blooded Indians have tended to be the least favored, both by nature and man. Biological resistance to European diseases came first to those who were part European themselves, as well as being more likely to move in a social milieu where there were Europeans from whom they could acquire biological resistance, and social acculturation to the transplanted European civilization of the Western Hemisphere. In addition, both whites and mestizos often disdained and discriminated against the full-blooded Indians. The highland peoples of Peru, for example, the descendants of the Incas, were at one time referred to by the mestizos as brutes and savages, and were forced to step aside, sit in the back of buses, and otherwise humble themselves before those considered their social betters. The thrust of Peruvian education was to get the less assimilated Indians to acquire the Spanish language in place of the native tongues, which 39% of the native peoples still spoke as late as 1960, as well as acquiring the modes of dress and general ways of life of the culturally westernized majority. Western Hemisphere Indians can no more be summarized than Europeans or Asians or Africans can be summarized. Their cultural levels have ranged from the sophistication of the Maya, the Aztecs, and the Incas centuries ago to the primitiveness of the Amazon Indians to this moment. What is clear is that their world was irretrievably shattered, biologically, militarily, socially, and politically, and that their fate would henceforth be determined by how well they evolved new ways of dealing with a radically different and ever-changing reality around them.